download, the Funk Master himself, Hall of Famer George Clinton. From Mystery Science Theater 3000, Jonah Ray. And from the new movie, A Ghost Story, filmmaker David Lowery. And now, here's your host, the man who wants the funk, gotta have that funk, Justin Kaufman.
Oh, man. We want the funk. Gotta have that funk. Yeah.
Very excited to have George Clinton on the show tonight. I can't even help it. I can't help it. I'm so excited that I have multicolors in my hair. Multicolored dreads. Actually, if you've seen George Clinton lately, he's gotten rid of that look. That sort of like peacock look that George Clinton had for years with the red and the blue and the hair. He looks like Cedric the Entertainer now. He really does. He looks like, I was like, oh, Cedric. Oh, it's George Clinton. It's Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Got a great show lined up. George Clinton, the Hall of Fame band leader, producer, singer, songwriter, all around musician, and arguably one of the most influential musicians in American history. George Clinton joins us tonight. He is going to be at Pitchfork this weekend as we continue our coverage of the festival in Union Park. Like I said with Ann and Roe, it's interesting that George Clinton is on the bill with all the indie rock bands or the young artists. And he's not, you know, think about P-Funk, Parliament, Funkadelic, not the headliner, you know, it's sort of like. But I guess that's a, you know, they've been around long enough and you know, it's a certain generation that's into a P-Funk experience. Maybe not the kids with the 16-year-old kids with no shirts on. They're going to be like, "Hey, that's the sample from the Dre song."
I want to be able to see George Clinton and also be home by 7. So this is perfect.
Perfect for you. Exactly. I guess that does work out. We thank Pitchfork. Oh, it's going on at 9. It's too late. I won't get home till 11. No, he goes on at 4:30. Oh, God, thank you. My life, my Saturday night has been fixed. I'll be in bed at 9:30 like I usually am. So George Clinton coming up tonight here on The Download. Also, we got a great show lined up. You know, these shows come along, and it's a lot of times in the summer when we got great shows and experiences and festivals going on and movies opening up. You can get a lot of great people to come on the show. Jonah Ray is going to join us. Jonah Ray, comedian and host of Mystery Science Theater 3000, the reboot on Netflix. They're coming to the Vic Theater to do a live Mystery Science Theater 3000. How great is that? Two of them. They're doing back-to-back on Sunday. You go to the Vic and you can riff with the riff masters. Jonah Ray is the co-host of the Nerdist podcast. He's also the co-host of Meltdown, which is a stand-up showcase in the back of Meltdown Comics, which was also on Comedy Central. He's got his own show on CISO. Jonah Ray, an amazing story of a kid who grew up as a diehard fan of a show that he now hosts. I mean, you can't write that story any better. Jonah Ray coming up a little bit later in the show. My guest at the big table tonight, filmmaker David Lowery. His movie, A Ghost Story, is in theaters tonight. It is an independent film starring Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. And you've probably seen the posters or the trailers. It's the movie about a ghost. And a traditional ghost in a bedsheet with two holes poked out for the eyes. And it is a story about the afterlife. It explores. It is a movie about time, and it is about the exploration of the unknown. And it's also about patience, because in it, there are some shots in this movie that are so amazing and so long at the same time. I give a lot of credit to David, because going to watch the movie, there are scenes where it is intense, you know, 6 minutes of watching someone eat. Richard Roper's got a great review in the Sun-Times about it. He's going to talk about it tomorrow on Roe's show. But David Lowery, my guest tonight on The Download, will talk about it. He did Pete's Dragon, Disney Pete's Dragon. Also had some success with Casey Affleck's an indie film with Casey Affleck before. So he's been around. We'll talk to him about filmmaking and about testing the limits, pushing the limits of what an audience expects from a film. It's coming up at the big table. Josh Mogerman's going to join us tonight at 7:30. We're going to talk about the flooding that's happening in Lake County, McHenry County, Kane County. We'll continue to talk about that story. Obviously, the rivers, everyone's watching the rivers as many of them in the area crest, and then, you know, continue to have problems because more water is moving into the area as it travels south from Wisconsin. The floodwaters that from the rivers that crested in Wisconsin are coming our way. So it just exacerbates the situation. We'll talk with Josh, not just about that, but about as the president is in Paris, we'll talk about the Paris Accord, what it means that we're not in it anymore, but also what impact it has on climate change, not just when it comes to flooding, which, as we see in this situation, record-setting flooding, but also what it means for dangerous heat, which, of course, we have heat today. So there's a lot to talk about. Josh Mogerman coming up on the download tonight. And then the neo-futurists are back. It came from the neo-futurarium, justifying our love for the best, worst movies of all time. We've been doing it every Thursday. Tonight's our last one. Rachel Klaff in studio. We have named the best and will continue to do it. And tonight we'll give away some prizes if you can suggest the final movie. I think it'll be our fifth movie. We've had four so far, maybe five, because we were kind of on the fence on Puma Man. That one actually shows up in MST3K. But the great movies, Rachel will be in studio with Edward Thomas Herrera as well, and we will take your calls, 312-981-7200. So huge show tonight, news, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, show about Chicago, starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, it's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. I usually start, of course, with the top story, but this was breaking right now. This is a tweet that just came out. So the New York Times reports that Trump's staff tried to take Trump's admission that he knew about the June 9th meeting with his son, Donald Jr. They wanted to make that off the record while keeping other items from their interview on record. So what that means is, like we said yesterday, when the president came out and said, I knew nothing of this meeting, he was probably lying. I think I said 2 days and it wasn't even 24 hours. So, you know, that's the point we live in. So more on that story is the New York Times is reporting that the Trump staff admitted, and they wanted to do it off the record, but they admitted that the president knew about the June 9th meeting with his son, Donald Trump Jr., and a Russian lawyer, of course. And it's not surprising, right? I mean, everyone who's listening right now is like, yeah, well, we knew that was going to happen, so okay. A new health care bill was revealed today as Senate leader Mitch McConnell looks to appease the several factions of the Republican Party. What's different? Well, the numbers are a bit different, but the main stuff is that there would be money available to help offset costs for health care premiums. And it doesn't go as far as the last bill in cutting taxes for the rich, as two of the said taxes will stay. Well, but will that be enough? Republicans can only afford to lose two votes, and Susan Collins from Maine already said she's out. A handful of senators who are also not on board, but they say they can be swayed. I love that. I'll listen. Just drop the packages off at my office. So, Senator McConnell, time to get the banjo out and some homemade lemonade and make some house visits. Just that image alone. Well, good to see you, Senator. I brought my banjo. Can I play you a song while we talk about whether or not Medicaid should be stripped? Too early to tell if this bill is DOA, but the plan is if the plan is to bore us to death with procedural stalls and policy debates, it's working. It really is. The deal is done, and the Sun-Times is now owned by former Alderman Edward Eisendrath and a slew of investors. The Sun-Times named the investors today, and it's everyone from labor unions, former politicians, a screenwriter, and Linda Yu. Linda Yu from the news. She now owns the Sun-Times, and I'm okay with that. I'm okay with Linda Yu being a newspaper tycoon, aren't you? There's one person in this town where you're like, who's going to be my newspaper owner? Linda Yu. Congratulations, Linda. Even though there are labor unions in the investment group, the investors spoke out today saying there would be no influence or interference to undermine the credibility of the newspaper. This was at a press conference in the West Loop, where the Sun-Times will be moving when their lease is up soon. Great. Sun-Times is moving to my hood. Now the line for the really expensive sushi burrito place, it's going to get super long. Great. Lake County officials appear to be bracing for the worst as rivers in the county crest today and tomorrow and will flood surrounding areas. And it may get worse because water in the Wisconsin area is traveling south after rivers are cresting at record-setting levels. In one case, the trip says a river is 2 feet higher than usual. It's the first time ever. Lake County officials have declared it a disaster area. It's so bad that the chain of lakes has been shut down, and they're asking residents to get their boats out of the water. It's July. That's crazy for a boat owner. What a bummer. You get only 3 months as it is. If I were going to take my boat out right now, might as well just take it out for the entire winter. Done. Boom. It's too much work. President Trump's lawyer, Mark Kasowitz, snapped at an emailer. And of course, it's in the news now. When a stranger emailed him saying, resign now, Kasowitz shot back with a string of profanities. And this awesome ditty. I already know where you live. I'm on you. You might as well call me. You will see me. I promise, bro. The president's lawyer uses bro as a sentence. Bro, period. That sounds less like a response to a crappy email and more like an exchange with a bouncer and a drunk outside a club. Bro, go home, bro. Bro, why are you being like this? Bro. Bro, I love that word. The fantasy sports companies FanDuel and DraftKings were going to merge, and now they're not. Today, they called off the business deal. Most speculators believe it was because they never would have been able to clear antitrust laws since the companies would represent 90% of the daily fantasy market. Others just deleted the email and thought about whether or not they'd stick to their strategy of all running backs. Really doesn't affect anybody. In weather, the flooding of area rivers, still the big story, but this heat got to be the close second. Gosh, I had to walk to get my discounted iced coffee from Dunkin' Donuts. Repressive. Ugh. In sports, how about it? A crosstown trade. The Cubs make a move for starting pitching and acquire White Sox ace Jose Quintana. And the White Sox were successful in getting back some prospects, including the Cubs' number one guy, Eloy Jimenez, who's an outfielder. The Cubs gave up 4 minor leaguers in total. This is a good trade for both teams. Although the minute Quintana gives up a 3-run homer, Cub fans, going to go berserk. Quintana was thought to be the biggest arm on the trade block, and the White Sox had held on to him up to this point to make sure they got the best haul in return, and it looks like they got it. So a blockbuster? Although minor leaguers don't necessarily make it a blockbuster. So how about a blockbender?
Yeah.
Quintana joins a rotation that's desperate, need of reinforcements, and he's under control for a couple years, so the Cubs automatically cover themselves for when Lackey and probably Arrieta walk free agency this next year. Although control's not all it's cracked up to be, Cubs. See Alfonso Soriano? You had that control? That was under control for a long time. Control goes both ways. But it's a good bet on Quintana, who has been pretty crappy on the south side lately, but had a couple good starts in the last few outings. And now the Sox add to what's already the best farm system in baseball. Jimenez was considered the 5th best in the minors. Pitcher Dylan Cease. Is it Cease? Yeah, is it Cease? Got to come up with a nickname for that guy. He ranked 83rd. This gives the White Sox 7 players in the top 100, but I say at least 10 since Zach Collins, Carson Fulmer, and Zach Birdie are still around. May I project 2020? Listen to this. Jimenez, Robert, the kid from Cuba, Avi Garcia, they're in the outfield, Abreu, Moncada, Anderson, and Jake Berger, this year's first-round pick, in the infield, Zach Collins behind the plate, and Rodon, Kopech, Giolito, Fulmer, Cease, Lopez, Dunning, Hansen, and Birdie all on the mound. First time an 11-pitcher rotation in baseball history. Hallelujah. Baseball is so fun when it's on paper. The Sox aren't done either. Melky, Frazier, Robinson, Holland, Shields, they need homes too. Also, reliever Nate Jones out for the year with an elbow injury. In basketball news, Rajon Rondo looks to have signed with the New Orleans Pelicans, where he'll be reunited with DeMarcus Cousins, who they said to be like brothers. So again, Rajon Rondo has found a new team before Derrick Rose has. Wow. And in WNBA news, the Sky are finally putting some wins together with back-to-back Ws for the first time this year. I mean, they're still the worst in the Eastern Conference, 5-12. But hey, the rally starts now. And finally tonight, did you see Sammy Sosa lately? The internet has gone crazy from his latest appearance where he dons a pink suit and hat and is noticeably lighter skinned in a video package for the Home Run Derby. Great jokes at his expense lit up the Twitterverse, like comparing him to the Pink Panther, or that he looks like Pepto-Bismol, or my favorite, that he's turned into the milk at the bottom of a bowl of Fruity Pebbles. Sammy, I'd say it's all in good fun, but it's Twitter, so probably not. That's the carryout for July 13th, 2017. In honor of this muggy day, we're giving away wet wipes with your order tonight, so you can wipe away all the sweat and smell like rubbing alcohol for the rest of the night. Yummy. All right, coming up, Josh Mogerman. We'll talk about flooding. We'll talk about heat. Talk about Paris. And George Clinton coming up tonight. Jonah Ray. David Lowery. His movie, A Ghost Story. It's The Download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
Hey, buddy, what's going on?
Not much, man.
Pete and I just had a very brief off-air meeting during that last commercial break. I won't be with you tomorrow afternoon or tomorrow evening. I'm going to be Judy Pilak tomorrow, so I'm going to take her shift.
Okay. Who's in for you?
I don't know.
I need to remember that because when I go into the crosstalk with Ro, my back is to the screen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I don't, and I always just like on faith, like it's an improv game where I'm like, I'm just going, yes, and I'm going to know that my partner is there and it's going to be Rob Martier. And sometimes I go, here's Rob Martier. And they go, and it's David Jennings.
It might be David Jennings. It might be Jennings.
Not so much. It's me, David.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's the 50-50-50 sale.
You guys both have the best radio voices in radio. So
his is good.
Yeah.
His is remarkable.
All right. Well, we got any big plans? Anything good?
I'm going to be leaving for Wyoming for a week.
Nice, man.
Yeah. The twins who just graduated from high school and my dad. So the Martier boys out in Wyoming. Nothing will be the same in that state.
I love it.
I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, that's going to be good. Yeah. All right. Well, we're looking forward to hearing about that.
You bet.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, David Lowery is going to join us. We're going to talk about his new film, A Ghost Story, which stars Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara, and really takes a look at the afterlife. It's almost like a new take on the haunted house genre. What happens after we die? That's the conversation that's coming up after 8 o'clock tonight here on the download. But right now, let's talk about what's in the news. Of course, flooding. And the rainfall and the cresting of the rivers in the areas like Lake County, Kane, McHenry, Northern Illinois is a serious issue. Continue to be. They're talking about the flooding of the rivers tonight and tomorrow as more water comes in from Wisconsin, rivers that have already crested and come down and travel south. This is a serious situation. The chain of lakes have been closed, and we continue to deal with a storm that came in very quick. And dropped 6 to 8 inches in areas of Northern Illinois. That's like that. We had conversation yesterday with one of the directors of the Lake County Stormwater Management Commission. Tonight, Josh Mogerman from the NRDC is in to talk about floodplains, flood insurance, and how this pertains to climate change. And before we get into like the idea of making that political, it's not a political thing. This is exactly what scientists say is going to happen in the future when it comes to storms in our area, where we have these moments where these storms come in really fast. Good to see you, buddy.
Thanks for having me back in. That's exactly right. I mean, you talk about 8 inches of rain in just a few hours in, you know, just north of the city in some of those suburbs. That is what the climate scientists are saying is going to be coming a lot more frequently, and it's time for us to think about how we deal with these issues. We're certainly seeing them more now already.
You know, this storm has been one that, you know, is well documented. The journalists in the area doing great work of being able to tell the stories, but it's such heartbreak to see the photos and the video and the stories of people who have to leave their houses, flooding in the basements, not just their basement, but their yards, their streets. I mean, it's Lake County calls it already had called disaster. The state of Illinois is getting there. I mean, is this going to be something that we're going to see more and more of in our area? Or like you said, Josh, is this something that that, you know, because it's not the first time these rivers have flooded, that that just is part of being by a river.
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. And certainly we've talked about the impacts of these more violent storms that we're seeing regularly in Chicago, with the Chicago River reversing course and flowing into Lake Michigan. We're seeing that in other parts of the city where the Chicago River has gone over. We saw it earlier in the year in St. Louis, where the rivers went up over their banks and flooded out I-55 for a period of time. This is something that is happening more frequently. We also have the issue of a lot of development along the floodplains, particularly in the suburbs here. And that is another problem that we're seeing, real issues all over the place. You know, I happened to watch the WGN TV news last night, and their coverage from the chain of lakes ended with somebody saying, well, you know, that's the price we pay for living in a floodplain. There's a recognition that maybe we're developing in places that are putting people in harm's way, and it's time to think about how to deal with the financial cost that comes from that.
And that's a great point, because yes, you live on a floodplain, and there has been a little bit of roll the dice in the past, but as these storms change because of climate change, you're going to get them more normalized, more in succession, more consistent. How do we deal with that as a community? Because flood insurance comes into play, cleanup costs, county costs, state costs. I mean, if this is going to be the kind of storm that comes through the area on a more consistent basis, do we have the resources to deal with it?
Well, so one of the things that's important is to plan for this. We need to put a lot more thought into our stormwater systems and investing in the sorts of resources that hold that stormwater, collects it, keeps it from going into people's basements in the city. That's green infrastructure. That's like the planted roofs and open space. In other places, it's thinking about how we are using those retention ponds and building in infrastructure to hold that water when we when it comes in really, really fast. And it's also the financial infrastructure. A lot of people have are part of the National Flood Insurance Program. That's a program that right now some real reforms are being considered. There's a bill being discussed in Congress. It's a Republican bill. You know, you were talking about let's not jump to climate change. That is that's a controversial issue. But in this case, there's a recognition that we are spending more on flood victims than we are bringing in the National Flood Insurance Program. And we need to be able to deal with that. The folks who are stuck in this cycle of flooding, who live in floodplains and want to get out, or they're done after a couple of floods and they're sick of rebuilding their homes, we need to give them better options. And so part of that is thinking about our policy and fiscal landscape around these storms and how we deal
with it. Yeah, I mean, that is a great point. I mean, there's been much made about what FEMA can do and what the, as you just mentioned, National Flood Insurance can do to essentially buy out and not force people to leave, but to say we could buy this property because it's not going to be, if you go to the market, you're not going to be able to get money for a place that's going to be in a floodplain. But talk about that. Talk about, is that sort of where you see the government going to sort of recognize that we're in these places that are going to be affected by climate change, buying them out to get them to a higher ground or to get them out of harm's way that wasn't harm's way even 50 years ago?
Yeah, you know, we just posted an article on our website on nrdc.org that looks at where the money for the National Flood Insurance goes. And what we find is that there are a lot of places where taxpayers have rebuilt people's homes a few times. Those folks don't like that cycle. They want out of that, and we need to give them options. So that's the beginning, the recognition of money that maybe we need to be spending differently. It points to some other bigger issues, and that is this is a problem that we're just starting to see. It's going to get worse. We need to deal with climate change, which is part of the root of the problem. We need to think about our zoning laws and reform some of those to deal with these problems that we're only starting to see the worst of. There's a lot more of this coming.
You know, it's turning from water to heat. You know, the president right now is in Paris. There's been talk about sort of bringing up the Paris Accord. Of course, that was the big news a couple months back about pulling out of the Paris Accord. And the NRDC and others have talked about what the implications are. If we're not going to be dedicated to reducing fossil fuel, one of the areas they say will that this will manifest itself if we don't try to bring the limits down is heat waves. We saw this in Chicago in 1995, obviously the most famous. But this idea of the sustained 4, 5, 6, 7 day heat wave with no break, we just like with floods along the rivers and quick storms, without reducing fossil fuels, you believe this will be the future and the norm for us here in Chicago?
Yeah, it's a real problem nationally, but it's particularly bad here in Chicago because of both our climate, but also this issue of heat islands, where in a big city like Chicago, the heat is absorbed and sticks around longer. It's why it's part of the reason that that heat wave that you talked about in the 90s killed 600 people over just a short period of time. We ran numbers, we looked at the climate projections, and we came up with some things that are really frightening in terms of tens of thousands of people, additional deaths beyond what we see now if we don't deal with climate change in the coming years. We're talking about something like an additional 14,000 Americans could die annually by the mid-century if we don't get serious and offset some of the worst climate impacts that are already being predicted.
Is that the only way to do it, is to reduce fossil fuel use? I mean, is that really what we're looking at? Is it as simple as saying, find out ways to curb emissions?
We need to lower our carbon footprint. We need to reduce fossil fuels. We need to think about other areas of the economy. We need to look at aviation. We need to make our buildings more efficient so that we're using less energy in the homes. And that's stuff that we think about every day. When you buy a refrigerator, you look at the Energy Star program. It tells you which ones use the least amount of energy to give you the same amount of cold beer that you get normally. Those are things that we need to get really serious about. Unfortunately, those are also programs that are being cut by the current administration. So there's real concerns about how quickly we can ramp up and do what we need to so that we don't see this big human toll.
You know, everything we're talking about here is this idea that we could see right in front of us a change in our planet, and that change is having negative consequences. We see that right now in the northern suburbs here in northern Illinois. And on the same time, what has to happen is that resources from some sort of government, whether it be local, state, federal, has to go to that to change the way we think about these things. When the administration that we currently have has suggested, the House budget suggested, I forgot the number, 7%, 10% cut to the EPA. They want
a third.
But, I mean, that's the Trump, but what the House wants is less. But my point being that, like, it feels like I'm trying to reconcile with the things that we see on the street and everybody sees with the responsibility of the government to change the way that we allocate resources or try to change the way we live so that we can deal with it. There seems to be a gap in that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think to deal with this problem, this is an all hands on deck issue. Everybody, every level of government needs to engage. And right now, I'm not particularly happy with what I see on the federal side. But closer to home, we've got things to be happy with. The Future Energy Job Act just became law in June. Illinois is stepping up. Incentivizing clean energy, incentivizing energy efficiency. We're going to be a leader in the nation. You look at the work that the city of Chicago has done to advance sustainability efforts, to advance renewable energy. The rubber hits the road in the city and the state. These are where we're dealing with the impacts. These are folks who have their hands on the ground, or their hands on the folks who are really having to deal with these impacts. And those are the places where you're seeing policies going in a place that are going to help. We need to do more. We need to do more quickly. But all isn't lost just because we're not seeing what we want to see in D.C. right now.
It's a fascinating look at floods, climate change, flood insurance, the heat index, everything in between. Josh Mogerman from the NRDC joins us regularly here on The Download. Josh, thanks for being here, man.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's going to be a big day tomorrow. We'll talk to you about the rivers cresting, the Des Plaines River, the Fox River, both expected to crest. I mean, it's amazing reading these articles today. I don't know much about river flooding. It's just not something that I've spent a lot of time, and I was curious and paying more attention to it. But they said that the Des Plaines River in some places is cresting at 17.5 feet. And that is alarming because it's 1 or 2 feet higher than it should be. Most places it's 6 feet, 7 feet, that kind of stuff. But there are some places where it gets that deep. That's crazy. The thing that's crazy to me is acting like every time we have one of these storms, like it's an anomaly. That, oh, yeah, it's just, geez, what a terrible storm. That's terrible come through. And it's not belittling anyone who's going through it because it's terrible you're going through it. But just wonder, and that's what we're talking about, whether or not as a society that we should say this is not something that we just can just put our hands up and go, oh, shucks, I guess we'll just, you know what, we'll just, as humans, we'll let the planet die and we'll die and then there'll be an ice age and then it'll all start, you know, like that concept is strange to me. And frankly, I think as you get to a certain point where you're like, okay, you know, there's been enough accuracy in predicting what's going to happen from scientists and seeing it happen, where severe weather, and Pete, you and I, we're on the air, Rob's on the air. It seems like this summer, it's every second day, there's a, hey, can we interrupt real quick? There's severe weather coming through the Chicago area, whether it be down south through Joliet or north. We have two or three storms now that have been north coming, rapidly coming through our area and hitting the northern suburbs, you know? So I don't know. I'm eager to see, you know, not to be negative, but I'm eager to see what the outcome is from this storm, you know, on the people who are living through it. So, like I said, I mean, you and I, yesterday we talked about it. I mean, it's painful to think about what people are going through. You know, to see the pictures of people waiting and grabbing things out of their garage. Awful. While they wait and at waist level, where they can't get, or they've been evacuated from their houses and they're not able to get there till. Yeah. So Chicago and the area reach, you know, feels for the people that they're going through. And I think the conversation with Josh is interesting about what do we do as a society when it comes to the resources allocated to response. You know, I mean, you get to a certain point where you're like, if this is going to happen every 4 or 5 months, maybe we should stop making developments along riverbanks, you know, where this kind of thing happens. And that's something that they've been talking about along the Des Plaines River for. I had a friend who lived right there, and I don't think she knew what she was getting into. And I think that she was here for 10, 15 years. I worked with her, and she said that half the time it was the river would rise, you know, and would flood the yard, things like that. She doesn't live here anymore. She moved, so. Anyway, we've got a great show coming up tonight. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, tonight, let's talk ghosts. Well, specifically, a ghost story. My next guest is a filmmaker. David Lowery is well known for his independent films, including the modern Western Ain't Them Body Saints, which starred Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara back in 2013. And on the heels of that Sundance success made the Disney live-action film Pete's Dragon. His new film, which he wrote and directed, is called A Ghost Story, and it's out in theaters tonight. It's a film that reunites Affleck and Mara. The film explores the afterlife. But it's much more than that. It's a stirring tale of existence, romance, identity, and ultimately letting go. And even though the ghost has a familiar look, a white sheet with eye holes, it's a new take on the old haunted house genre. The old saying goes, home is where the heart is, but in this film, it may be home is where the soul goes. A Ghost Story was a hit at Sundance, and the film is being distributed by A24 Films, and filmmaker David Lowery is my guest tonight at the big table. David, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So, did you set out to tell a ghost story?
Yes, because the image of a ghost in a bedsheet in an empty house was sort of where I began with this project. So, it was always going to be a ghost story, but I didn't know quite what form it was going to take.
What about it? What about that concept, the idea of a bedsheet and taking the old classic ghost, as we all know it here in pop culture history, and playing off of that?
Well, to begin with, it made me laugh. And laughter is a wonderful gateway to all sorts of other emotions. And something about that image, which is so childlike and so naive, in an empty house just felt sad as well as humorous to me.
Right.
And I wanted to sort of see like how far we could take it. How much leeway could we get with a guy in a bedsheet in terms of taking audiences on an emotional journey?
Do you have a do you have a love or a fascination with ghost stories, with the haunted house genres, or was it truly just this idea of this image of a guy in a bedsheet makes me laugh?
I've always loved haunted house movies. I've loved horror movies of all shapes and sizes. I mean, that's one of my favorite genres. Favorite things to do at the movies is to go get scared. And I've always wanted to make a horror film. And while this movie isn't scary, nor is it a horror film per se, it does employ the language of the genre to different ends.
I guess you can't put it in the horror genre because it doesn't have that, you know, that,
yeah,
that fright.
Yeah.
You know? But, I mean, it is a story about ghosts, and it is a story about death and afterlife. And there's a lot in there that does play along the idea of what we're not necessarily comfortable with, this idea of what happens to us when we die.
Correct. And I suppose the closest thing it comes to being a horror film is that some people have said that it's existentially terrifying. And I would subscribe to that. Yeah,
it
ultimately, I think, does have a happy ending, but for a while there, things get pretty bleak.
After you realized that, okay, I'm laughing at this bedsheet.
Yeah.
You know, was that the intent? The intent, once you started to delve into the idea of what happens to us after we die, was the intent to go after a story of the afterlife, to almost be the guy who explains how it works?
No. I mean, while the movie is meant to be taken at face value and the story is meant to be very literal, I am not, you know, hypothesizing that this is what happens to us after we die. I think that ghost stories, horror movies in general, but ghost stories in particular, are very good at giving voice to fears that we have as human beings. And they reflect fears and concerns and ideas that we deal with in our everyday lives in a very potent fashion. So on that level, the film is a metaphor. Mm-hmm. And I definitely do not believe that we all wind up as bedsheet ghosts haunting the places that we've once lived. But I also don't know what happens to us after we die. So that's one of the things that makes this movie a universal experience, is that we all do spend a lot of time thinking about that. And even though I don't think anyone's going to go to this movie and think, ah, this guy's got the answers, it does engage with that thought, yeah, process that we all participate in.
Is it easy or is it a challenge as a filmmaker to work around something that nobody knows? We don't know what happens. So does that make it, you have creative license to hypothesize however you think?
Yeah,
it's gonna go?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, I think there's a lack of specificity in this movie, which I find personally helpful. We never like show, you know, when there's a door that opens at one point, and you don't see what's on the other side of it. And that's important to me. There are other movies that have shown what's on the other side. And that's great. Like Defending Your Life, the Albert Brooks movie. I do not believe for a second that that's what the afterlife is like, but I love seeing that version of it.
Yeah. There's something really great about this movie in the way that it is plausible. It makes sense that, you know, we could, mm-hmm, possibly inhabitate where we live.
Yeah.
And also be around after we die. You know, I think that when watching it, it wasn't necessarily that this was, yes, this is how it happens. But there's something beyond just the idea of a ghost story, but there's something spiritual about what happens to our, not just us, but our loved ones,
yes,
after we pass.
I mean, there's two sides of that coin, and they're both very potent, and they both mean a lot to me. One is the classic idea of that everyone wishes they could be a specter at their own funeral to watch people grieve for them, which is, I think, just a sort of an ego trip of sorts. It's an extension of our egos that we wish we could be around after we're gone to watch how people deal with our absence, because we all feel, to some one degree or another, self-important enough to feel that, you know, we will get to see people miss us if we were so lucky to,
yeah,
do that.
Right, right.
And then the flip side of that is we don't want the people that we love around us to be gone. And we would love to have the comfort of knowing that our loved ones are still with us, not just, you know, in whatever afterlife we might believe in, but in the rooms that we inhabit. That is a very lovely and comforting thought, and one that I don't think is necessarily untrue. I do think that when you leave a room, you leave a little bit of yourself behind. Whatever that is impossible at this point in human history to quantify in any sort of way, but I do believe that to be true. And to that extent, I suppose you could say I do believe in ghosts.
A Ghost Story is out in theaters tonight, opens up tonight. The writer and filmmaker David Lowery is in studio with us here at the Big Table talking about the film, which stars Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back and we'll talk more here at the Big Table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, filmmaker David Lowery. His film, A Ghost Story, opens up tonight. Chicago, you can see it at several different theater houses. it's a movie that's getting a lot of attention, a lot of buzz, because it played so well at Sundance. And one of the things I love about it is it kind of was a secret movie.
Yeah.
It stars Casey Affleck, and there was this thought of, I mean, at this point, anything that Casey Affleck does, we all know about it. But it kind of came out of nowhere. It was, I mean, talk about what it means to be a secret movie.
You know, whenever you make a movie of a certain scale, it gets announced in the trades. You know, that's the first thing that happens. In Variety or Hollywood Reporter, they'll say, this actor is attached to this project and it's going to start shooting in 6 weeks. And as soon as that happens, expectations are set for the movie. People start to imagine what it's going to be or where it's going to premiere, or just, you know, they'll start assigning various values to the movie that don't actually exist.
Right.
That is fine for some movies, but for other movies, it can be a burden. You know, as a filmmaker, you're aware of that, and you start trying to match those preconceived notions and try to set out to achieve what you are imagining other people are expecting the movie to be.
That's interesting. You feel that as a director and as a filmmaker when the buzz comes from, David Lowery's working on a new film, that you feel that stress?
To a certain extent, yeah, because I always am making movies for audiences. I want to make audiences happy. And yet at the same time, the best way for me to do that is to just make myself happy. If I'm thinking about anybody else, usually the movie starts to become diluted or watered down because I'm just trying to please all sorts of imaginary people out there. And if I'm just trying to please myself, you know, I go to the movies all the time. I see everything. I love movies. And if I am trying to satisfy myself as an audience member, I know that it will reach other people as well. But it's easy to get distracted from that.
Do you have to negotiate that? I mean, with agents and managers and people in Hollywood who want to say, we want to tell people that Casey Affleck's shooting this film.
In this case, no, because we didn't tell anybody, and Casey and Rooney were both very excited about the idea of doing something completely under the radar. So there was, you know, a little bit of, you know, interaction with their agents because we just wanted to make sure that they, you know, they were signing up to do a movie that was incredibly low budget, far smaller than anything else they've ever done, but we wanted to make sure in case it sold they would get some, you know, some profits. Yeah. And so we had a brief contract written up, and for all intents and purposes, everyone assumed this was going to be a short film because the screenplay was only 30 pages. We never said it wasn't a short film, but when you see a 30-page script, you just sort of assume, oh, this is a short film. So a great way to get Hollywood to ignore what you're doing is to just say you're making a short film. And no one paid any attention to us, nor did they spill the beans.
That's such an interesting idea that it's 30 pages because, you know, and I was reading a little bit about some reviews about, you know, maybe one sentence for one scene.
Yeah.
And what we see on the screen can be 5-10 minutes long. If you were writing the screenplay for this, and there's a lot of silent moments mm-hmm. in this, there's a lot of patient moments in this, it has to help you that you wrote the short film because you can take liberties as a director to really suss out what you want from that one sentence.
Exactly right. And sometimes those scenes that are so simple were very thoroughly described. I would put a lot of novelistic, prosaic description in to really convey exactly what was supposed to be happening. But other times there were scenes that consisted of a single sentence that said, the ghost sits alone in the house. And then we can kind of extrapolate from that on set and figure out what room is he in, what's going on, like what is the value of that scene. But it was indeed very simple and very mundane. The script did not like go into great depths of like emotion. You know, I wanted to leave that up to be discovered on set. But if you were to read the script now after having seen the movie, you would say, oh, yeah, that's the movie I just watched. But there's a lot of subtext and such in there that you don't get until you're watching the images on screen.
There's a feel and an emotion in the movie of watching a scene that we're used to as movie watchers, to be in a position where we're going to see cuts or we're going to see something come from a 2-3-4 minute scene. That doesn't happen necessarily. But there's something eerie and emotional about sitting in the moment in the theater and experiencing that at the same time, in real time, as the actors on the stage.
Yeah,
the
it really, to me, punctures through the inherent artifice of the filmmaking. Because, yes, we are conditioned to expect a scene to last a certain way and to be presented within a certain running time. You know, you want, if someone's talking, you expect that reverse shot to come into play at a certain point. And when you remove those expectations, where actually you can't remove the expectations, but when you take that
challenge them, right,
you take that away, you are forced to just reconcile with the image before you in a different fashion, and you really become aware of the time that it takes to watch something and to engage with something. You engage with the image in a new way. If your mind wanders, that's also okay. And, you know, there's some of these shots in this movie last long enough to where if your mind wanders, the shot will still be going on when you get back to it.
There's a conflict that goes on as the viewer. I mean, it's fascinating. It's a great lesson in art, in the way that you are have these expectations that film has put on you, that there is going something is going to happen, or there is going to be a cut, or like you said, a reverse shot.
Yeah.
And when it doesn't happen, you find that there's a conflict in you where you're like, I don't know. You almost step out of it, and then you step back in.
Exactly.
And that to me, I find it to be truly original and artistic achievement, in the way that you are pushing not only against me in the seat, but against all of the other movies that have trained me to watch film.
Yeah, there's something uncomfortable about it. But at the same time, the one thing that defines film and separates it from all other art forms is time, the usage of time to tell the story or to present an image or to convey something. And I really wanted to take advantage of that. And so time in this movie works in an unusual way. It is at times very, very slow and forces you to really luxuriate in a moment. And other times it speeds by so quickly that you can't keep up with it.
It's
and
a character in the film.
It really is. It really is.
Having this at Sundance and other places and the scene where Rooney eats the pie,
mm-hmm.
which is getting pulled out in the reviews and what have you, you saw how audiences reacted to something like that. You've been in that position. How have they reacted to having somebody just eat for 5 minutes on screen?
Better than I thought they would. You know, I was expecting a mass exodus at Sundance at that scene. As much as I loved it, I think that's the of all the films I've made, that is the scene that I'm the most proud of. And it's two shots. In total, they're 10 minutes, but the real one that everyone talks about is about 4.5 minutes. And I can tell you that it's 4.5 minutes, but it doesn't really matter, because when you're in that moment, it lasts an uncomfortably long period of time, and it was meant to be uncomfortable. But beyond that discomfort, audiences have found it to be greatly moving and emotional. People start crying during it, and then other people are just so relieved when it's finally over. And some people do walk out. There have been, you know, people who can't just aren't interested in it, and that's fine.
As an artist, as a director, as a filmmaker, do you have to push against a feel? Like when you say, I want to shoot this, I want to shoot it real, I want to shoot it a certain length. Do you have the same moments where you're like, okay, we're good, and I got to push myself through?
I do. I mean, ultimately, every shot in this movie is judged against the standard of my own tastes and my own sense of patience. And I have a very short attention span, so it takes a lot to get me to look at something for 5 minutes. But at the same time, there's actually something quite peaceful about that, because every time you make a cut in a movie, you are having to make a little mental connection. You have to actually exert some energy to like make the connection from one shot to the next. And when you're freed from the responsibility of having to do that, it's actually quite relaxing. But I definitely want to push myself as a filmmaker. I want to push audiences who might not be used to this type of filmmaking a little bit outside their comfort zone, but I never want to alienate anybody.
Yeah.
This is meant to be an inclusive movie that everyone can enjoy together, hopefully in a theater on the big screen. And as challenging as parts of it might be, it's never meant to be, like, literally uncomfortable.
I don't think it comes across uncomfortable. I love the artistic, I don't want to say experiment, because it's not an experiment, but that is something that I'm just not used to in the film, and it really, I think it resonates with audiences because it is something that we're not used to. David Lowery is the filmmaker, writer, and director of the film A Ghost Story, starring Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. All right, we'll take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back, and we'll continue our conversation with David here at the Big Table. Stay with us. More with David Lowery coming up here on the download. Movie A Ghost Story, starring Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara, is in theaters tonight. It's at the Landmark. It's at River East. Some other places in the Chicago area. I think a couple in the suburbs, maybe Evanston. We'll continue our conversation with David Lowery coming up here right after Rob's news, which has to include the blockbuster trade today. Jose Quintana and four minor leaguers from the Cubs farm system.
Wow.
I had a Sox fan friend of mine say was upset because he said, how am I going to feel when Jose Quintana lifts the World Series trophy over his head at the end of the season? And, you know, we didn't get that. All we have is these prospects that may or may not work out. My response to that was, how are you going to feel when Jose Quintana gives up six runs in the first inning of an NLCS?
Right.
If you're a true Sox fan, you know that's what he's going to do.
So is his friend, does he think this is the linchpin? This is what's going to turn the Cubs season around?
Yeah,
Quintana?
he just doesn't like, he said his next post was, I wish they would have traded him to the Brewers.
Hmm.
And he just doesn't, I think that the, part of the psyche, and we may talk about this tomorrow too, but the psyche, this weird trade, Kevin Powell kind of, he referenced it when we talked last week, that there rarely ever is a crosstown trade because of the media in this town, but also the fans, that every time Quintana gives up a hit, they're going to be like, oh, the Sox. And every time Quintana gets a win, they'll be like, oh, the Cubs. It's just too much riding on the rivalry. I guess it's kind of the same feeling when, you know, you might have a trade between the Packers and the Bears.
It's all part of the White Sox master plan.
Yeah,
World
right?
Series, all right, that's fine. We got ours in 05.
Now, I hope what happens is all these stars come up, and they do to Rick Renteria what they did on the Cubs, where they just got rid of him after 1 year and they got Joe Maddon. But it should be Ozzie Guillen, right? Bring Ozzie back to Chicago for all the youngsters. Watch that implode. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, David Lowery, the writer and director of the film A Ghost Story, which opens tonight in Chicago theaters after being a hit at Sundance. Stars Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. It's a movie that has a tremendous amount of buzz. It's funny how many people I saw the film, and it stayed with me for a couple of days. I talked to some friends who came into town, my wife, others, and they all knew the film because it was, oh, the bedsheet ghost.
Yeah.
I've seen that. I said, what is that? You know, they want to know. But for you to skip the pre-buzz and get to the point where you're at now where it's about to come out, but there is a lot of buzz. There's people want to know more and more mm-hmm. about this story, ghost story, mainly because of the way that you deploy the ghost.
I mean, there is no doubt about it, some degree of a stunt to that. You know, like the fact that this is the movie in which a character is wearing a bedsheet is wonderful trivia. You know, it's something that makes the movie somewhat easy to market because everyone is very aware, like you said, like people hear about it and they see that image and it is intriguing. And I remember last spring I was shooting a movie in Kentucky and went to an AMC theater and saw this gigantic standee for our little ghost movie. And that was my first inkling that this might be reaching a wider audience than I had initially anticipated.
When you made the movie and made the 30-page
yeah.
you know, that into a feature, did you not think it would be at a point where it's opening in Chicago on a Thursday night in places like River East right around the corner?
I had zero expectations. I hoped that the movie would work and you know be a movie that I was proud of and that I could happily put my name on, but I didn't expect it to reach the lengths that it's reached. And I didn't expect it to get into Sundance, which it did, and I didn't expect anyone at Sundance to love it, but almost everyone loved it. And now, as it trickles out across the country, the amount of support that it's getting has been really humbling. And, you know, like I said before, it's not a movie that's meant to be exclusive, but at the same time, the nature of it sort of suggested to me that it would have a very small audience. And the fact that the audience turns out to not be as small as I initially thought has been wonderful.
You know, with your success that you've had, and I kind of mentioned in the beginning, the Ain't Them Body Saints, which was Casey Affleck and
yeah.
Rooney Mara as well, and then getting the chance to do the live-action Pete's Dragon. Now you have the success here. With all the risk-taking filmmaking that you do, which we talked about in the segment before, about longer shots mm-hmm. and really playing with the expectations of an audience, as your career grows and you get the opportunity to work on new projects, maybe more Disney stuff or what have you, do you worry about losing that ability to be creative or take risks on projects like you do with this movie where there are 4.5-minute scenes of one thing happening?
To a certain extent, but I think every movie has its own set of risks, and if there aren't those risks implicit to it, it's probably not worth doing. You know, I want every movie to challenge me and to provoke me in the experience of directing it, and as I seek to do my best on every film, I want there to be new challenges that I have to overcome because that is going to help me grow as both a filmmaker and as a human being. So I don't worry about yeah. that particular risk. I feel that I will always have, if I get to the day one of principal photography on a movie, it'll be because I'm invested in it enough and feel comfortable enough in my approach that I'm not worried about losing track of my creativity or losing track of my voice. What I'll worry about is like actually making a good movie. And sometimes I worry about that more than others, but I always know if I've made it all the way through the development process to the set and the actors are there and the camera's there and we're about to start rolling, I feel pretty confident about what it is that I'm doing.
Do you see the film before it's done? Meaning, when you have the vision at the beginning, as a filmmaker, as someone who really has become a creative force in this industry, do you see the film, and then when it's done, you're like, that's exactly how I saw it? Or do you discover things while you're shooting and in the editing room that change the conception of what you wanted a ghost story to be?
Yeah, I definitely discover things while I'm shooting and while I'm editing. And there are always these wonderful little seismic events in the creative process that change what it is that you thought you were making. But they don't change it completely. They just color it slightly in a different way. And so for all intents and purposes, the finished product that we now have that is opening tonight in Chicago is a movie that looks exactly like what I thought it would look like. Really? When I first conceived it. And yet there's all these little differences along the way. There are all sort of things I could never have predicted or anticipated or expected. And yet inclusive of those things is this finished product that is a remarkably close facsimile of the movie that I saw in my head. Now, that's not always the case. It was the case with this movie. It was the case with Pete's Dragon. But I kind of had to learn how to let that happen, because with Ain't the Body Saints, that movie wound up being quite different from what I initially thought it was going to be. And I had to reconcile with that. I had to deal with the fact that this wasn't exactly what I wanted to make. It changed, not in a negative way, but just became something different as we were making it. And I love being open to those opportunities. I love being open to spontaneity. But it's also important to remember what it was that made you right. want to make this movie in the first place, and to stay true to that.
When you're taking on a movie like A Ghost Story, which is about ghosts and the afterlife and what happens after you die, and you get to the point where you finish the film, it's based on your own script, and you have this amazing opportunity to see it on a big screen.
Yeah.
Does it teach you about the things that you set out to do? Meaning, you know, it's a story about ghosts in the afterlife. Do you take away for it, like kind of like I do? I mean, look at it and I say, I become existential in the way that I'm like, okay, what really does happen? Or that makes me think about what happens in my house, or all the things that when the book gets knocked off the piano, things like that. Do you have the same feeling after you see your own movie?
I do on this one, but I can't quite explain what that feeling is yet. Normally when I watch one of my movies, I just see the technical details, because I've been working on it for so long, and it's very difficult when you're in the weeds to really see the movie as a movie and to look at it objectively. This movie, for whatever reason, is the first film of my own that I've made where halfway through the movie I can forget that I made it. I forget what it was like to be on set. I forget what it was like in that house or to be directing someone under a bedsheet, and I'm just able to watch the movie. I forget what happens next. And that's a wonderful thing as a filmmaker, to have that experience. And so when I first watched the finished cut of the movie right before Sundance, when I was just checking the final mix and checking the color, I was left with a feeling I couldn't quite explain. It really felt like I'd had an experience that was separate from my experience as a filmmaker. And so what I get out of it is something immense that I haven't completely reconciled myself with. It leaves me feeling very comforted, but in a way that I don't know how I got there. And so I look forward to actually watching this movie again, which is a really rare thing for me to say, because usually as soon as I know my movies, I don't even sit through the premiere. And when I'm done, I'm done. But this one, we showed it in Europe last week, and I was able to watch like the first half, and I just did not want to leave. And that is a rare luxury for me.
I wonder how much of that familiarity has to do with family, the way that you shoot this and having Casey and Rennie again.
Yeah.
You know, and this idea that does it become less of the technical sort of, I'm making a film and this is a film set, and more of we're creating together because we're so used to each other. There's a familiarity to each other.
Definitely. I mean, that's why I like to work with the same people repeatedly. And, you know, Casey and Rennie have become friends since our first film. So it was very easy to reach out to them as friends and say, hey, do you want to join some more friends in Texas this summer? And we're all just going to make something together. There's less business and there's less discussion. The atmosphere is rife for creativity when you're surrounded by people who trust you and who you trust. And that's just a wonderful thing. It's not right for every movie. Sometimes you need new people or you need conflict or whatever. But for the right type of movie, it's just best, like a movie like this, you can do no greater favor than to surround yourself with people who you would want to be hanging out with, even if you weren't making a film.
Do you find yourself now as a filmmaker, as you move to next projects, are you going to look to delve into bigger ticket items like this, like the afterlife or ghosts? You find yourself now gravitating towards the topics that may go unexplained.
Maybe. I mean, it depends on the project. But I mean, I often deal with big issues that are just slightly intangible. And this one's easy to kind of put in a box because it's literally about a ghost. But I just finished shooting this movie with Robert Redford that's very much a movie about getting older. And that's something, again, that we're all going to deal with. That's a big issue, a big ticket issue. And we're not dealing with it. We're not hitting that nail on the head, but the movie is all about that. And I'm writing a movie for Disney that's an adaptation of their Peter Pan animated film. And that's a movie about just growing up. And, yeah, right. And that's another one of those. Like, it's easy to forget about that because Peter Pan is such a well-known commodity. But and there have been so many Peter Pan movies. But that's something that remains true. That's the reason why people are attached to that story and keep wanting to revisit that story, is because we all have had to deal with that sad inevitability that we will, you know, that we have to grow up.
Growing up and letting go.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. David Lowery, my guest, a filmmaker, writer, and director of the film A Ghost Story, which opens tonight in Chicago, starring Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. David, thanks so much for sitting down and being my guest tonight at the Big Table.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
I think it's safe to say that I have never seen a movie like that in my life, A Ghost Story. And, you know, you go see these movies, and a lot of times you see them in advance. You see them at screeners. They have a screener downtown, and you go with different journalists, and you walk. And I it's famed in journalism worlds that that's where Roger Ebert was, Gene Siskel. Like, this, they have certain seats that you're not supposed to sit in, right? That's sort of the thing. So that it's already a little stressful because I don't know, and I only go because I want to see the movie before I interview someone like David. So it's always stressful to me because I'm like, oh, man, I'm sitting in the right seat. Just imagine, you can understand. I wish they had, like, ticketed, like it was at Roosevelt Icon, where you're just like, oh, I know what my seat's going to be. So, yeah, I've been okay with that. And in this case, I also don't know what the etiquette is. Do you stay for the credits? Do you not stay for the credits? Do you, you know, they don't have trailers and things at the front. They start the movie, it goes. And most of the time, there'll be a lot of critics and writers in the room and broadcast people. The credits start and they are to the elevators. They got to go. Got to get to the next project. And so I kind of got into that vibe. Watching this movie and it's ending and it rolls the credits with no music. Just like a behind it. Not one person left. Everyone watched the entire credits, and it was a slow credit. It's not, there's nothing special. I started thinking, I'm like, do they know something I don't? Is there like a Marvel Comics, you know, secret ending that I'm not, you know what I mean? Like, are we waiting for something? But yeah, but I mean, everyone was just like reflective. And I've never seen, and I thought, well, maybe it's because I've had such limited experience in seeing those that maybe that's the right way to go. No, I saw another movie the day later, and it was like, shoo, shoo, out, gotta go. So it was, this movie had an impact on the critics watching it. And Richard Roper's going to be on Road tomorrow talking about it. So you got to catch that probably in the 5 or 6 o'clock hour. But I mean, it's a polarizing movie because, you know, it's a very interesting idea. You know, this idea that Casey Affleck comes back as a ghost and he's got a bed sheet and two holes, but they don't play it for jokes. It's not like, Casper.
Right.
You know, he's in the house as if he would be a haunting ghost, but he's got that look. And they do a lot of, David, and he talked about it in the interview, but a lot of patient filmmaking where there are 2-minute scenes, 1-minute scenes, 5-minute scenes where nothing happens. Rooney Mara eats pie. She sits down on her floor and she eats pie. And your brain, it's hard because your brain is like, it starts to, because you've been wired by movie industry and what's a good movie and reverse shots and cuts and 3 seconds and 6 seconds and something's got to happen. She sits on the floor and she eats pie.
What kind of pie?
I don't know. They don't say.
Couldn't tell, huh?
I thought maybe it was like a meat pie. Because I didn't know, it felt like a moment where she hadn't had dinner. You know, but that's, I mean, it is startling. It's stark, startling, and a great piece of art.
Yeah, I have to say that you, I mean, And I find it interesting that you feel a little bit weary of going into these screening rooms, because you've been doing it for quite some time now.
Yeah,
going
I still
to,
do.
You know, every couple of weeks there's something. And I have to say, like, yeah, out of all the films that you have seen, this one you definitely have talked about. I don't know if you've enjoyed it the most, but you've talked about it.
I talked about
it.
Yeah. I bothered my wife at home about it. I talked to my buddy who was in for 4th of July about it. And it's funny because most everybody goes, oh, yeah, I saw something on that. You know, it doesn't matter who you're talking to. They go, oh, yeah, I saw the trailer for that. Just happened last night with Jen and Amy, who were on for Patty. Jen Bosworth and Amy Guth. They said, oh, what? Who? David Lowry? A Ghost Story? I don't know what that is. I go, it's the one where Casey Affleck's in the bedsheet with the eyes. Oh, yeah, I saw something on that.
Yeah.
And it's because it's just such an interesting concept, and you see it in the posters, or you see a trailer, or you see an article about it. And a lot of, I read the New Yorker about it, and there was this, I don't know how many stars you can give it, but the New Yorker gave the full amount. And it was funny because in it, they kind of made fun of me. Yeah, they were like, and don't listen to these fly-by-night critics who can't handle watching a scene where she eats pie. It's art. Deal with it. And got one of those, like, in the piece. Like, and I was like, oh, maybe that I'm sure it informed my thought on that scene. Because before that, I was just kind of like, well, nothing happened. It was really interesting. I just say it was I would recommend it. Because I'd love for people to see it and then be able to text in or call and get your opinion on it. Because I don't know what to think of it. I really don't. I mean, it's not one that I'm not a critic. I'm not a film critic. I don't go to review the movies. Richard Roper is king of that. He gets paid for that job.
Yeah.
He has the experience and the tools and the skill set to do that. I go because I'm going to talk to the guy, and it's probably bad form to talk about someone's film for 40 minutes if you haven't seen it.
Yeah. I'll definitely go see it this weekend.
Yeah.
I'll make sure to text you about it.
Please. And I'll make sure to text you about fantasy baseball, which is back tomorrow. That's become my – Pete and I, our relationship is me telling him how my fantasy baseball team did. And then he acts like he cares, which is great.
I do care because I find out about players that I have no idea that are even in the league.
Like an Andrelton Simmons?
Exactly. I mean, when I was a kid, I knew every player on every single team.
Do you think I
barely know the Cubs.
Do you think that Andrelton is a family name? Do you think that they were like, you know, that's his Uncle Andrelton? It's Andre, but like LTON on the end. Andrelton Simmons. He's a shortstop for the Angels.
It's a good name.
Andrelton. Yeah, I just wonder, like, where does that name come from? It's kind of like want to be like Carlton, but what if but his dad's name is Andre, so Andrelton, right? That's all I can think about. That's as far as I got in the thought process of that choice. But that's how I pick my guys on fantasy baseball. I want to see I want to know all about them and if they're good influences in the locker room, you know. And if I have to cut somebody, I usually will do an all staff with all my guys on the team and be like, you know what, this guy was a cancer. He's got to go. We're bringing in a guy off the waiver wire. He's a clubhouse guy. Not so good with the stats, but he's a clubhouse guy.
Really? As a GM, that you're taking that in your clubhouse guy for fantasy.
Absolutely. It's all about, to me, it's all about the clubhouse.
Like last year, he had David Ross on your team because he's a clubhouse guy, but plays once every four times.
Yeah, exactly.
For games.
And I'm also any guy who was on the 2003 All-Star team. Like, I'll take. If they're still playing in the league, if any guy's over 40 in the league, he's on my team. Like, I love it. I'm like, oh, awesome.
Yeah,
you're still playing.
You do say that. Yeah,
oh, Carlos Beltran's still playing.
Matt Kemp. Like, that guy's still
Matt Kemp's pretty young. He's only like 34 years old. I'm talking about like an R.A. Dickey.
Oh.
You know, or Carlos Beltran. You know, like, Carlos Beltran's still in the league? He's still in the league, that guy. And I'm like, that's a guy that I want on my fantasy team. Good clubhouse guy.
Is he though?
He's on the Astros. He's on the Astros. I don't know. and guys like that, they don't play every day, so it's the worst kind of guy to have on fantasy because you're like, I've got him on the team, and he's sitting on the bench. But a good clubhouse guy. Good clubhouse guy. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, we continue our series of interviews surrounding the Pitchfork Music Festival, which is this weekend in Union Park. And the festival usually has something for everyone. And speaking of someone for everyone, the festival welcomes one of the all-time greats, George Clinton. George Clinton is a Hall of Fame musician, producer, and bandleader. His groundbreaking work with bands like Parliament Funkadelic led to a new funk sound that's still unrivaled in American music. Clinton has produced numerous hit records and even more hit songs and continues to tour either solo or with the P-Funk All-Stars. And his music continues to be a central part of American culture. Think of artists like Dr. Dre, Ice Cube, Outkast, Tupac, all sample the sounds made famous by Clinton. It's safe to say that George Clinton is one of the most influential artists in music history. He plays Saturday night at 4:15, and he is my guest tonight. George Clinton, welcome to the Download.
Thank you. Man, that was a nice build-up there.
Well, it's well-deserved. This Chicago has been such a big town in your history, just with Parliament Funkadelic coming through. What are some of the memories about playing Chicago coming through?
I can go from Ocean 11 in the 60s to the 78 at Soldier's Field with the mothership landing to, you know, throughout the history of Parliament Funkadelic. Until lately, we go to every year. We play two or three times a year. Glad to be there this time. We used to play the Bud Billigan Parade and all of that.
But Chicago's got a rich history in the blues and jazz and soul music.
Yeah.
Do you recognize that and relate to that as the guy behind P-Funk?
Oh, yes. I mean, we recorded most of our music in Detroit. So we shared a lot of the musicians back and forth in Detroit. So we shared the musicians in the late 60s with Chicago. And, you know, I'm a fan of Curtis Mayfield, Carl Davis, and all of the R&B stuff from the late 50s and 60s. So I've been hip to Chicago throughout all of its, from Freddie King and Albert King and all of that, you know. So the blues and everything. So, yeah, Chicago is always a great place for us to come.
Reading some of your background, your history, I mean, starting off in music, not in funk music, of course, but also having a stint as a staff writer for Motown Records, I want to know how you got to the P-Funk sound. What was the moment in which you said, you know what, I'm not going to do this Motown stuff anymore. I'm going to invent something new. I'm going to branch out.
That moment was easy because as we got our first hit record, I Want to Testify in Detroit. As soon as we got that hit record and got out on the road, we ran straight into albums like Sgt. Pepper and Cream, Disraeli Gears, Fresh Cream, and Sly Stone. All of that stuff hit us right in the face as soon as we got it. We had been in love with doo-wop, you know, from, like, you know, early days of Chicago, Spaniels and all those Eldorados and all that. But then Motown came and changed us. And then here come this rock and roll from Europe. And we knew Jimi Hendrix, you know, his Jimmy James and the Flames. We knew it. We saw what he had done. But are you experienced all of that in 67 when Testify came out? We realized as soon as we got a hit record, we had to change real quick to keep up. And so after Testify, we did a couple of more records. But then immediately we took our band, you know, which was kids, Billy Nelson, Eddie Hazel, and we made what we call Funkadelic, because the Motown band was called Funk Brothers. They named them the Young Funk Brothers, and we just added Delic because of all the psychedelic stuff that was coming around. So we did Music for My Mother. That was the next album on Funkadelic, and we were the Parliaments became the Funkadelic backup singers. They had been our backup band, and so we became their backup singers, and we stayed together forever.
Wow.
Called the Parlor Funkadelic Mint Thing. it stayed that way until, you know, 72 when Bootsy came.
Right.
He brought Fred Wesley, Maceo Parker, and his brother. We had to change again. So now we got Parliament and we got Funkadelic both going now. So you hear from them again when Up or the Downstroke come out on Parliament. Oh, and One Nation come out on Funkadelic.
This is amazing to think about this. At what point did you realize that the Parliament Funkadelic experience was taking over American music? Where were you at when you realized first you got the records that are coming out, but when you get, you talk about songs like Up for the Downstroke or One Nation Under a Groove. When did you start feeling it as the band leader that you're onto something? You're going to end up in the Hall of Fame.
I felt that early, much earlier. I mean, I felt that back in the Maggie Brain days, but it just took a longer period of time. I knew it was going to take time, but I knew that all along that we were got accepted as a different type of band, which is the hardest thing to do, is to be accepted as a band that can do anything they want to do. Mm-hmm. And it was just a matter of time before we would revert back to our Motown days, skills of writing songs that was for radio, because we stopped even trying to do radio with Funkadelic. As we got with Casablanca, Neil Bogart, I knew this was the perfect time to go back to the commercial because he was a promotion man. He had a good team, and it was just like Motown. So we did Up for the Downstroke was our attempt now to go commercial again, and Chocolate City was right after that.
Yeah, right.
And then Mothership Connection. We pretty much had it mapped out from Up for the Downstroke. We knew we was on our way then.
Do you know, as Parliament and Funkadelic and two separate bands, but also playing together and the musicians that you brought together, not just for the tour, but for the recording. You mentioned Maceo Parker and Fred Wesley, both guests on this
Bootsy
program before.
I mean,
and Bootsy Collins.
He was a big part of that, you know, because he brought all of them with him. And he was the sound of Parliament, along with Bernie Worrell, Gary Scheider, and the rest of us who have been Funkadelic all this time.
As a band leader, what are the challenges as a band leader to keep all of those things happening? We're talking about all these tremendous talents, but also tons of people in both bands and recording.
I had learned from Motown, and you know, that Motown touring band and all the acts that was around the company. I had got used to that family situation, which, you know, is what we pretty much based all of it after Motown, you know, with Bootsy and then the Horny Horn. Everybody was a star. That's the way we looked at it. The girls, background singers became Paulette and the Brides. Fred West and them became the Horny Horns. So everybody got a shot. I knew I had all that talent. It was just a matter of letting everybody become an artist. And then Eddie Hazel, Bernie Worrell, they had their own records out. That was the easiest way, but you don't count on the company to try to get their pick and then, you know, subvert the whole thing. We wasn't counting on that. But it didn't stop us. We here again, and the band is out there now. A lot of them are my grandkids and my kids, along with the band, Funkadelic, you know, who's been there forever, Blackbird,
yeah.
Gray Boy, you know, the horn players, all of them, they've been there since the 70s.
Jeez. Which do you prefer, George? We're talking with George Clinton, of course, the Hall of Fame musician with P-Funk, Parliament Funkadelic, and, of course, his solo work. Which do you prefer? Do you prefer being the band leader? Do you prefer being the producer behind the board? What's the most, I guess, quality for you? Like, what experience? Which do you prefer as the leader?
Making the music in the studio, working with different people. I just did the album 2 years ago with Kendrick Lamar, To Pimp a Butterfly. When I get a chance to do stuff like that, I have a chance to reiterate what we've been doing all this time. That helps me being able to play not only how you make the music, but how I get marketed, finding new ways to be heard, you know, because it's hard to get on radio once you've been there before. So now we do the Periscope. We Periscope our shows. So we end up now, we sell out everywhere we go. We got a new album out, came out over a year ago. And it's just not getting hot because Shake the Gate, Parliament album, will be out September of this year. So we working in the studio, it helps me dictate how we promote the stuff, what kind of music and all of that.
Yeah.
And once we get on stage, we always can work that out. That's never been a problem.
That's never been a problem. Just got to get the mothership there.
The mothership is in the Smithsonian now.
Is it really?
It's one of the main attractions there.
I saw you guys in Chicago probably in the mid-90s where you put, I don't know if it was the, it was a different mothership, but you, I can't believe how many people you had on stage at one time coming out of probably a simulated mothership. But the idea that there were 22, 23 people on stage, it was crazy.
Where was it at?
It was at the Riviera.
Oh, that club. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We used to play that China Doll or something.
Yeah, China Club. Yeah. Okay.
China
so
Club.
Here, let me ask you this before we let you go here. It's amazing. I mentioned artists like Dr. Dre, Outkast, Tupac. You mentioned Kendrick Lamar, of course. In a way, you have been the grandfather of hip hop in the way that many of the beats that are used and the samples are from funk music, are from funkadelic. What does that mean to you? I mean, is that a good thing that the music has come out of the music that you made in the 60s and 70s?
It's a great thing because that keeps funk alive, and that hip hop is like the dominant music now. So it's a great thing. It's just that we have to now find a way to get paid, because the artists pay. They take the money from the artists, but the record companies don't have a way of controlling stuff, so they try to keep your money nowadays. They're not the dominant thing no more. The internet is. So they need product or needing some kind of way to put records out or whatever, they won't pay you now, so it's hard to get your money. But fighting for the copyright issues is my biggest thing right now. That's what gave me the energy to reinvent myself this time, fighting for the copyrights for my family and families of other, you know, musicians my age.
There's been a lot who don't have the kind of voice that you have that produced great music in the 60s and 70s that, yeah, they didn't have the copyright to the music. They lost royalties. They don't see anything when something's redone or resampled.
Right.
Do you see that as that's your fight, not just for you, but for a whole genre of music?
Yeah, for a whole genre of music, because, I mean, they was trying to make that acceptable, and it's not acceptable. You know, and with the digital age coming, you get a chance now to relitigate your point of view, because it don't transfer into the digital world as easy as it was, you know, on paper. You can't lie as easy with these codes and things. So we're actually getting, I got One Nation and Knee Deep. I got those two albums, and they're mine. I own them. Uncle the Hardcore Jollies and Electric Spankin'. I own those, and of course all the new stuff that I put out. We also put in for copyright recapture, and I got a lot of those back. So okay. I'm getting a lot of it back. Might get the monies that they've taken over the years, but I'll probably get a lot of that back too now, because, like I say, that digital thing show up on you, tell on you. Yeah. If you don't tell on you in this country, they tell on you in other countries, because you have to have the paperwork done right when you go to other countries. So a lot of them don't just go along with you being able to have lawyers coming in. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
A lobbyist changing laws. You can't do that as easy in other countries.
Well, from one fan here in Chicago, we hope that you get everything that you deserve for the music that you've produced over the years. Parliament Funkadelic. George Clinton is going to be at Pitchfork this Saturday night, the Hall of Fame all-time great. George, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk
tell
to us. I really appreciate
tell
it.
Everybody, I say bring two booties. One booty ain't enough to shake. Okay.
Thank you.
Surprise!
I could let this go all night, man.
Oh.
It was funny when I did go see P-Funk at the Riv. You know, Rose got a better story. He's talking, oh, I saw him at Soldier Field. I saw him at the Riv when they're like on one of their nondescript off-year tours. You know, where they're playing. They're just like phoning it in. I remember being on the side there and I was like, I was with some pretty inebriated roommates. I remember that. I just remember everyone being a little bit too, like, pre-party. The pre-party was too much. But I remember going, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There were 23 people on stage. Like, Bootsy Collins was there. There's a whole band, but you were just like, they just kept coming out of this simulated mothership that was like, you know, on the side stage, and there'd be like fog, smoke machine, and these guys in like, you know, like star uniforms would come out, like space uniforms, you know, they'd come out with their guitar.
At least they're doing something. It wasn't they were just like hanging out.
I mean, how many rhythm guitar players are there? You know, like I just felt like there were like 9 guys with guitars. They're just like, yeah, you can come on stage and fake guitar play. It's such a great, great to have George Clinton on. How great is that at Pitchfork? I hope, you know, I've been at Pitchfork for a couple of shows where it's been like someone awesome and the shirtless 16-year-old crowd is like, meh. I hope there's no meh for George Clinton, right? I mean, I know it's a young man's game, young person's game, and Pitchfork will be just, as it always is, littered with kids that are 17 to 21. But I hope they do their homework and want to watch George Clinton P-Funk on stage at Pitchfork in Union Park. I live not too far from Union Park. I might have to just put my ear to the old window.
Yeah, I mean,
for the bass line coming out on that one. Boom, 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 boom.
And if there are more people at the vegan ice cream line, I am going to do some damage.
Are you going to the festival?
Yeah, I'll probably go.
Oh, look at you. Yeah, I'll just casually go.
For, you know, I'll probably go in the afternoon.
For an hour.
Yeah, a couple
get
hours.
Get some vegan ice cream.
Yeah.
Check out in the back with your arms folded. Get upset when someone bumps into you. Oh, God. Until the last time I went was to see Chance the Rapper coming off of the Surf record, right? Donnie Trumpet Surf record. And my wife and I went there, and we realized quickly, we're like, wow, we're not the right age for this. I felt really old. Like, I was very self-aware because it was just kids. And at that moment, a friend of ours, daughter, 16, 17 years old, she's like with her crew, like just creeping through, like sliding past us. And my wife was like about to say her name. And I'm like, nah, you don't want, what's she going to do? She's going to turn around and be like, oh, hi. Yeah, how's everything going? Have you talked to my mom lately? Like, you just, it's like, come on, there's nothing we can do here. Let it go. Anyway, so fun to have George Clinton on the program. So fun to have him here. All right, coming up, Jonah Ray is going to join us. Mystery Science Theater 3000, the tour coming through the Vic on Sunday. Talk about the reboot, about Jonah Ray. I love Jonah Ray. He's a host of Meltdown with Kumail Nanjiani. Also, he's been all over the place, stand up and you can see him on CISO. He's got his own parody travel show that's kind of like Anthony Bourdain. Talk with Jonah Ray coming up after the news. Stay with us.
Mayday, mayday, mayday. We need your help.
We need my help.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is an actor, writer, and stand-up comedian, and he is the new face for the reboot of Mystery Science Theater 3000. Of course, I'm talking about Jonah Ray. Ray is getting more and more deals in television. The stand-up hosted the Comedy Central show Meltdown with Jonah and Kumail, alongside Kumail Nanjiani. And he also hosted his own travel show, well, the parody travel show, called Hidden America with Jonah Ray on CISO. Ray is also the co-host of the Nerdist podcast, and he's coming to Chicago this Sunday night for a Mystery Science Theater live tour. They're going to be at the Vic on the North Side for 2 shows. The first will present the movie Egon, and the second, well, It's a surprise. Jonah Ray, welcome to the download.
Thank you. You make me seem like I'm very successful, and I appreciate that.
Well, I am a big fan of yours, and I really love what you guys do with Meltdown, not just the TV version of it, but the stage as well. All right, let's talk about this tour. I mean, you guys started it off just in July. How's it going for you, and are you excited about coming through Chicago?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we just started it, which it seems like it was 17 years ago, but I think it's only been about 6 days. I've never gone on a tour this intense before, where it's on a bus and, you know, we do the shows and then we, you know, do the meet and greets and then we get in the bus and go to the next city. But as tired and exhausting as it all is, it's like the shows have been so much fun and so invigorating to do this show in front of a live audience.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's made me just so energized. And Chicago, you know, my wife's from the North Burbs of Chicago. It's one of my all-time favorite cities in the entire world. And so I love the Vic, and I cannot wait to come to Chicago and do this show.
What's it like for you? I mean, you've obviously had so much experience performing in front of a live audience, but doing Mystery Science Theater in front of a live audience, that's a whole other skill. What's it like to be able to riff off the movies with a live audience with you?
You know, it's a lot more fun. You know, when we're doing the recording the riffs for the shows, for the Netflix show, you know, it's real intense. We got to stick to the schedule, and you might mess up stuff, or we have a high volume of riffs to get to. With the audience there, it's just you have to readjust your rhythm to what they're feeling. So, you know, if you have a riff after a line and the audience goes crazy for it, you might have to drop some lines and maybe just in that case add some new tags that you just thought of right there for that joke because people responded to it so well. And it's just such an invigorating way to perform. And it's also, you know, it's so much more fun to me than, you know, doing stand-up because it's stand-up, it's just you up there. But with this, there's like little sketches, yeah, and props, songs. It's just it's a whole show. And once it starts, you have to go for it. There's no stopping the train. And that's what kind of makes it exciting for me because stuff will go wrong because it's live comedy.
Right, right.
And so I really dig that, you know, the audience is responding to, you know, like little mess ups here and there. And then we're able to kind of roll with it. So it's a lot of fun.
You know, you're in the best of both worlds where you have a new crowd that's coming out for the reboot that's on Netflix. But of course, Mystery Science Theater 3000 has a very loyal and rabid base, and they come out for shows like this. What's it mean for you to be a part of this team now, to be a part of, I mean, it's more than just a show, and it's an experience, an American experience.
Yeah. I mean, I was obsessed with it growing up. It was one of the things that inspired me to get into comedy. You know, the thing I connected with it so much was it was, you know, so punk rock without being punk rock. It was just these guys in this town in the Midwest just putting on a show, and it just had this raw energy that I really connected with, and it made it seem attainable, just like how, you know, punk rock did for me music wise like I'm like, oh wait, that's like, you know, you don't have to be a stadium performer, you don't have to be, you know, Dane Cook in an arena. You could just, you know, there's different levels to all this stuff. And it really, you know, just made me obsessed with it. And I was obsessed with it for years, you know. And the fact that I get to be in it now is just mind-boggling. And I still, you know, it's like, it's really odd because it's like I am a fan. And then I'm now meeting fans of the thing I'm also a fan of. So I feel like every time I meet a fan that comes to the meet and greets or tell me how much they like the new season, I feel like I'm just getting to hang out with a fellow fan for the show, but I'm also a part of it. It's a real head trip.
Jonah Ray is my guest tonight here in the download. We're talking about the Mystery Science Theater 3000 tour, which is coming to the Vic on Sunday. You mentioned punk rock. I mean, that is, you kind of came up with that. You were a punk rock musician. You came to L.A., you know, and made a transition to be a writer and an actor. But talk about, do you have the dream to be in music, to be a punk, or is it more of an aesthetic?
No, I mean, it's like, it's still, I still play music. I still like have a band. It's with a couple guys, one guy from Desaparecidos and one guy from the Blood Brothers. You know, it's just, it's like a fun kind of side project thing. It's something I never really put away. But when I moved to LA, it was with the intention of doing comedy and, you know, performing and acting and doing stand up. But the thing about it was that all I grew up with was punk rock. So I didn't know how to find where comedy was. I didn't have the internet at my disposal. And so I ended up just kind of drifting back into playing with punk bands and hanging out, going to shows and being a roadie for different bands. And so I just kind of dropped it all and just started, you know, looking up open mics in the local weekly.
How much of that experience of the punk rock, as I mentioned, aesthetic, but the idea of putting on your own shows and, you know, being the guy that, you know, can do anything at any time, anywhere, how much of that aesthetic helped you as a stand-up and as a writer moving to L.A.?
Oh, you know, the punk rock idea of DIY, do-it-yourself, is so ingrained in me and very important to me. And, you know, that was the thing I liked about it is that, you know, in putting it onto comedies, it's like, I'm not going to wait for someone to put me on the show or give me a show. I'm going to have to make it myself. I'm going to have to do it myself. You know, with the Meltdown show that Kumail and Emily Gordon did together, it's like, you know, we just like, well, let's just start our own show. And like, we'll have our own show this week. And, you know, and then it became a TV show. But you never start any of that stuff with the intention of it going anywhere. You do it because you want to and almost because you have to do it. That's the feeling right. of it. And being able to just kind of not be too precious of anything and just, you know, trying to get the thing done, because the work is the work and anything outside of that is beyond your control. So that's the thing that I always kind of held true. I put out like a 7-inch record of my stand up before I should have ever even tried recording myself. But in my head, I was in band. And when you have enough songs for a 7-inch record,
you just do it, right?
Yeah. That's kind of what I've approached everything in my life with. And it's you know, it's exciting to see it actually work out as opposed to being a failed experiment.
Well, you've had success. I mean, you mentioned that Meltdown, even Nerdist, and what you're doing, Mystery Science Theater, the show on Netflix and the tour. It's an entertainment. It's in obviously in the industry. It's Hollywood, but it is that fringe, almost on the cult kind of following. As you get more and more popular and more opportunities, are you going to look for projects that continue that aesthetic, that punk rock aesthetic that you just talked about?
That's the plan. You know, I've had a lot of opportunities to take money gigs, and if it doesn't coincide with what I want to do and the type of stuff I want to put out, I tend not to take it. I did a commercial, I did a few commercials for a search engine that wasn't Google a few years back. And on the heels of that, I got offered a lot of stuff. I was like, hey, we want you to host this science show. Or we want you to host, you know, it was straight up offers. But my whole thing was in my head. My mantra was make stuff, not money. So make stuff you're proud of. And hopefully if you focus on just making stuff, the stuff will lead you to have money so you can make a living and then therefore create more stuff. But if you're doing something just to make money, you're going to find yourself in a situation where you might not be too happy down the road. And you kind of wonder what if maybe if you'd taken a different route. I was a producer from writing comedy, bits and sketches on one show. I got pushed over to another show where I was a producer for an E-Countdown show about insane celebrity oops. And it was one of the most miserable experiences of my life, where I made the most money for the least amount of work. And I said, I could stay here. Yeah, exactly. And I told myself, I could stay here and make money and impress some ex-girlfriend that broke up with me because I was broke. Or I can just kind of, you know, quit this and make the jump and believe in the process.
Okay, so to this Sunday, you got two shows, Mystery Science Theater Live. What can we expect from it? Because you mentioned it's not just watching the movies. There's opportunities for sketches, other things like that. What can we expect from the Mystery Science Theater live tour at the Vic?
Well, it's basically a live version of the actual show. So it's almost like you're going to a taping of Mystery Science Theater 3000. You know, Joel comes out and greets the crowd, and then, you know, the theme song starts. People are singing along. You know, I come out with the bots. We have a whole Satellite of Love set, you know, there and a screen, and we're interacting with a pre-tape with Felicia Day and Patton Oswalt. And then, you know, we got movie sign. We go and we riff on the movie live there, and then we come back out. It's just an actual show with, you know, invention exchanges and sketches and songs. And it's a real trip to see live because you're in it. It's a thing that I mean, I got to experience firsthand. But to be a fan of a show like this, you want to be there and you want to be in it because that's what the show makes you feel like.
Yeah.
Kind of what this live show is like. It's like you get to go onto the Satellite of Love and hang out with the people that do the show that you like.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, our guest tonight, Jonah Ray, is the new face for the Mystery Science Theater 3000 reboot, which is on Netflix. And he will be part of the Mystery Science Theater live tour at the Vic. Two shows. The first one presenting the worst movie of all time, EGA. And the second, which is a surprise, both shows at the Vic Theater on the North Side on Sunday. Jonah Ray, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And I highly recommend that second show. It is a doozy. It's a terrible movie. I've been in cheesy movies, the worst I can find. He'll have to sit and watch them all, and we'll monitor his mind. Now keep in mind that Jonah...
It's a download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, coming up, 10 o'clock. It's perfect tie-in. Mystery Science Theater 3000, of course, celebrates as they put Jonah in a space module to monitor him or to punish him. I forgot what the they just said in the theme song. He has to watch bad movies. And the only way he gets to pass the time is got his robot buddies. Well, we have been for the last 4 or 5 weeks collecting the best worst movies of all time in our segment Justify Your Love for the best worst movies of all time. The friends from the Neo Futurarium at the it came from the Neo Futurarium, the stage reading series of the best worst plays of or movies of all time, is on stage for one more Saturday. I think they got one more coming up here. Rachel Claff and Edward Thomas Herrera in studio tonight. 312-981-7200. That's the phone number. I want you to tell us what's the best worst movie of all time, and we'll give you a prize. Tonight, we will give you a pair of tickets to the 10th annual Chicago Blackhawks convention. How about that, huh? At the Hilton Chicago Hotel on July 21st through the 23rd. That's just for saying this is the worst. Now here's the rules. You have to say what the worst movie is, and you have to explain it. You can't just like text the name. Explain why it's the worst. And we've had rules in the last 4 or 5 weeks. If you listen, you know that you can't just, you know, parody movies or movies that are intentionally bad or movies that you never want to watch again. That's the great thing about Mystery Science Theater as well, is that when they have those bad movies, they're movies that are really hilarious at the same time and you want to watch them again. So far, we have 5 winners from the last 5 weeks. Ready? Yeah, 5. You ready for this? Number 1 was Bad Ronald. And Rachel sent me a list of them. She put the dates on them, too. The years, at least, right? So Bad Ronald was 1974. And this was the movie in which a boy was living in the walls of a house. His mom died, and they forgot that he was living in the walls of the house. So a new family moves in, and he peeks on the new family. It's like a thriller. Bad Ronald. Great title. The second one, that week 1, week 2, was a movie called Rabbit Test, 1978 movie, a comedy directed by Joan Rivers, starring Billy Crystal, who gets pregnant. The third was a movie called Tiptoes from 2003, whoa, a more current, where Gary Oldman and a cast of really like Academy Award winning caliber. I can't even, it was like a family thriller where Gary Oldman played a little person, even though there were other famous little people in the movie. Gary Oldman was the star, and I guess the trailer is not to be missed. If you want to get up on it right now, go find Tiptoes on YouTube, watch the trailer just to see what we're talking about. Last week we had 2 winners. That's what it was. First, The Puma Man, 1980. I can't remember the gentleman who called in, but it was such a great moment. He called in and you played the music underneath it, Pete. The Puma Man, or just Puma Man. The Puma Man, 1980. And then Viva Knievel, the 1977 Evil Knievel joint, in which Evil Knievel goes to Mexico. Unbeknownst to him, his hosts want to kill him and use his body to transport cocaine across the border. And the only person who knows this is his alcoholic mechanic, played by Fred Astaire. Who was it? Was it Fred? Who was it?
Gene Kelly.
Gene Kelly. Fred Astaire, whatever. Gene Kelly. And I love that in the actual description, it's his friend, the alcoholic mechanic. And so I guess he has to go to rehab, Gene Kelly, but so no one believes him because he's in rehab. And Viva Knievel's on his own against the Mexican cartel.
I want to say that I was also looking through the credits for that one. Leslie Nielsen is in it.
Classic.
And also, I believe Dabney Coleman is in that movie. But Dabney Coleman is also in Bad Ronald.
He is in Bad Ronald. He's made 2 of the 5. Dabney. All right, so Rachel and Edward are both in studio tonight, and we'll talk about the show they're doing Saturday, but we'll also be the judges on adding the 6th and final best worst movie of all time. Then we will have all six, and we will figure out what to do with them. It might be another show where we do a tournament to see which how they play out to pin. We might do some sort of event where we try to screen these. We may edit them all together to make our own best worst movie. A lot of options. A lot of options. This has been a lot of fun. I hate that it's coming to an end. But the series ends, I believe, on Saturday, the final one. Yeah. Again, Bad Ronald, Rabbit Test, Tiptoes, The Puma Man, and Viva Knievel. So there you go. So you can call 312-981-7200. You can text that number. You can tweet at WGN Radio or at Justin Kaufman. And we will get there, right? I'm psyched. I'm going to send a tweet out now, as I do. You know, just get it up on the old tweet deck to 140 characters. You know me, I'm a social media. I multitask while I'm doing live radio. I'm also like, hashtag Neo Film Fest. What's the worst? What's the worst? The best worst?
It's whenever I'm tagging things for the website, I always have a problem with Neo Futurarium.
Yeah, it's hard. They have a Neo Film Fest tag. Let's see if I can find it. Neo Fest, I think it's called. No, I lost it.
No, see, Smarty Pants.
Yeah,
you
I
can.
Thought I had it. All right, well, I'll get it in the break. I'll find it. I'll search it. All right. So we'll get to that coming up here on the download. Stay with us. All right, coming up here, I got the tweet out. I don't know if people were listening to commercials. You can hear I was actually doing. I kept the mic open so you can hear me going, and I got it out.
41 seconds ago.
There you go. It's pretty good. Yep. For you to justify my love. I can't do it. One more week of this song.
It's like a surprise, a gift that keeps on giving. Just surprises us every time.
There's something about this song. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman, it's time to justify your love for the best worst movies of all time. We've been doing it every Thursday for the past 4 or 5 weeks now. We're wrapping it up tonight after a strong... I just read right before the break, I read the five movies that are...
That won.
That have moved on to the semis. You know, that's what I'm saying. And it's pretty awesome. It's Bad Ronald, Rabbit Test, Tiptoes, The Puma Man, and Viva Knievel.
So good.
These are them. All right. So in studio tonight, Rachel Claff and Edward Thomas Herrera.
Hello.
Hello. Rachel, of course, the creator of It Came from the Neo Futurarium, the hilarious stage reading of the worst movies of all time, which is at the Neo Futurarium every Saturday. The last one coming up here on Saturday.
Yes, of the summer.
That's not right.
It was a truncated season this time around, but we had fun.
And the last one will be directed by Edward Thomas Herrera, who's in studio. Edward, I'm always been a fan of yours.
Thanks.
I'm so excited that you are at the helm of this last project.
I'm excited too.
Explain, is it Someone I've Touched?
Someone I touched.
Okay.
And so there's no contraction. There's no contraction.
All right, Edward. Let's. What's
Someone
what is this
I
movie?
Touched? It is a 1975 made for TV film.
The best.
Back when they used to do Disease of the Week. Do you remember that? Well, they called it Movie of the Week, but
really was.
It was really Disease of the Week, and the disease in this week was syphilis.
Oh, right,
or is syphilis. And unfortunately, Cloris Leachman has it.
Okay.
In the movie, right, in right. the I might want to say,
roll
in the movie, not in real life,
the
I have great respect for Cloris Leachman, and I'm sure with that vegetarian diet that she's been practicing for 50 years, she's...
So the movie, is it a sort of a tale, a cautionary tale of syphilis and sexually transmitted diseases?
Well, it's terrible, for one thing. And one of the things, it is a cautionary tale, but I think they were trying to do something about the what's the word I'm looking for? Not trauma. The stigma. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
The stigma of VD and the fact that people kept it quiet and they were so embarrassed about it that it actually only helped to spread the disease.
That was the point
of
this
same
film.
But at the same time, they're trying to do something of a salacious kind of potboiler drama. And so you can't have it both ways where you're like, let's just do something really racy and sexy and today. And then, but we have to remind everyone.
Yeah, legitimize
that every 15 seconds, someone in the United States contracts syphilis. And so we're going through the script when in rehearsals and we're just like cracking up with like, really? Now you're going to do the PSA?
Yeah.
Like right,
right
now?
In the middle of the movie.
In the middle of this?
Great.
Yeah.
Well, made for TV movies, Rachel, they hold a special place in the It Came From the Neo-Futurium
series.
Yeah,
we've done a few and they're always, I mean, a lot of them at least. You rarely get one that is trying to be campy, winky. A lot of the new ones do, I think, have a very keen eye towards, we're being silly about this. But some of the older ones, they just take themselves so seriously. And like Edward said, you know, they become these PSAs for whatever it is, disease of the week, et cetera.
Alcoholism, drug abuse. I mean,
yeah. Stephanie said there was a lot of witchcraft ones in the 70s too, you know.
Yeah.
Trying honestly and earnestly to address these issues.
And they all starred Shelley Winter.
Yeah.
Every single one. I think that was in her contract.
Yeah,
it's
right?
Like, if you got a witchcraft movie, I got to
be in it.
All right, Ms. Winters.
I mean, the great thing about it is it lends itself to great stage readings.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
The scripts of these are they really shine on their own, because with a made-for-TV movie, you have a lower budget, you have a TV budget, you don't have a lot of special effects, so you're getting the sort of raw, unvarnished, like, did they really just say, oh, yep, they did, yep.
And also, you're like, as I'm going through, because I had to do the transcription of the script, because
he was the only one who had to do that, because we found the others.
I'm listening to it line by line, and I'm realizing that's a flubbed line.
Uh-huh.
They made that mistake. They made a mistake, but they didn't go back to
can't
correct
fix
it.
Keep going.
Probably because they was like, okay, look, it's good enough.
We've got Leachman
Let's go.
For two more days.
Print it. Next scene. You know, and I really do think that they cut the scripts at the last minute, because like there are lots of things, and if you see the show on Saturday, you'll realize there are lots of stories that like start. And then they just disappear.
Don't go anywhere.
Or right. Lines that say people say, and then like there's no follow up to that line. I don't know. What
well, all right. So someone I touched is Saturday at 7:30.
Yeah,
at the Near Future Area.
Going out with a bang.
Ashlyn and Foster, right in Andersonville.
Literally.
Literally,
a bang. Thank you.
All right, 312-981-7200. All right, so we got some people on the line, and you know the rules of picking the best worst movie.
Yep.
You try to avoid the parody.
Yep.
You try to avoid the ones that are intentionally campy.
Bad. You want something that was so bad it's good. You want to watch it again. And I think the other
share it with your friends.
Yeah. Share it with your friends.
Yeah. And have some kind of connection to it that you remember it fondly, but not something that you go, oh well, that was awful. I never want to see that again.
This is not a movie, but Carl Lewis, the track star in the 80s.
I never want to see him again.
He made a music transition, trying to make a transition to an R&B star.
Oh, dear.
Right.
And he did a music video in which it was just a collection of clips of him racing. And then
That wasn't the party. I want to party
no,
all the time.
Oh, that was Eddie Murphy.
No, that's
that was
Eddie Murphy.
I forgot the name of this one. Build It Up or something.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But it was a collection of him in the gym with like leotarded women.
Which
and,
you know, let's be honest. He looked very good in a
he
leotard.
Did, and he was lifting weights at one point. He's singing.
Yeah.
And then it would just be a collection during the chorus of just clips of him winning races. So anyway, that's a music video that does not count.
I mean, if
no,
we want to open it up to music video.
You also brought up a good point, which is that we have talked about spin-off festivals.
Yes.
Of whenever someone does a career pivot that just should not have happened.
Oh.
So things like that.
Yeah, there
singing
we go.
Career. We threatened to do poetry readings of people who should not have written poetry books. Ali Sheedy. You know, things
Summers.
Like that. Suzanne Summers. Jewel. I'm looking at you.
Oh, Jewel. Oh, I was
It just
so
goes on and on. So then the career pivot thing always leads
always
to disaster.
Leads to something.
Including
right.
films.
All right. So we have it down. Let's get to some of the callers so we can get going here. We've got some people on the line, which is great. Let's start with Gary. Gary, what's your recommendation? What's your suggestion for the best worst movie of all time?
Well,
I haven't seen in a little while, but Cheech and Chong's next movie, and the name of the movie. And, I mean, you got Cheech and Chong. This is about the late 70s. You got Cheech and Chong.
Of course,
would think they would be funny, but you got, what's his name? Who was the bad guy? No, I can't remember his name now.
Stacy Keach.
Neither one of them. They wind up in outer space at the end of the movie.
Of course they do.
Cocaine.
Why not?
What's his name?
The guy that was arrested because he was a child molester. The little.
Oh, I can't say that I remember. Oh, Stephen Collins? No.
No. Very popular.
All right, we're listening to a lot of nonsense.
If it wasn't for my dementia, I would know his name right now because I knew it about 5 minutes ago while the news was on.
Oh, okay. All right.
Well, Gary, I like Cheech and Chong, but Cheech and Chong kind of falls into the category of they know they're making bad films. Right?
I mean, maybe they don't know, but they're so high that they think they. You know what I mean? It ends up being silly. Just by nature of getting high and making a movie.
I laughed really hard at Up in Smoke. That was their
that was the first. Was that the first
movie.
One?
I listened to one of their albums as a child so many times. I knew all their routines. And this was before I even smoked dope, you know?
Right. They played the XRT. On XRT, they always played the class, shut up. That was a Cheech and Chong.
Gary does bring up a good point, though, which is that one of the hallmarks of a good bad movie is that someone winds up in space.
Someone?
I mean, it just kind of...
the flaw, right?
Yep.
Right? Rachel Claff, Edward Thomas Herrera in studio. All right, so we got John coming up. Mark, I got some people on the line as well in the text. We are justifying our love for the best worst movies of all time. And we've got prizes. The winner tonight's going to get a pair of tickets to the 10th annual Chicago Blackhawks convention.
Ooh.
At the Hilton Chicago. So there you go. So we get prizes. Stay with us. We're justifying our love for the best worst movies of all time. 312-981-7200. If yours is picked tonight, you get a pair of tickets to the 10th annual Chicago Blackhawks convention at the Hilton Chicago coming up this week. I think it's next weekend, right? 21st? Yeah. Anyway, Rachel Claff in studio. Edward
Hello.
Thomas Herrera. It came from the Neo Futurarium, the hilarious stage reading series of the worst movies of all time. Saturday, Someone I Touched. Starring Cloris Leachman. She won't be at the reading.
No, sadly.
But who plays Cloris?
Noelle Krim is going to be playing, or I should say recreating the Cloris Leachman role.
And I should point out, she was the lead of our first movie, Caged, which we kicked off of, and she's wrapping it up.
She's the Meryl Streep of the It Came From the Neo Futurarium.
One of the things I've always loved about the series is some of the great neo futurists of the past and people who worked around will come back and be a part of it. So, Noel, it's great to have.
It's a delight
to have you guys all back on stage. All right. 312-981-7200. Okay, let's see. Oh, this is interesting. Let's go to Mark. Mark, what do you got, Mark?
Hello.
Hi.
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 Hey, my favorite bad movie, this is from the late 70s, the great era of bad
science. We had this one. Go ahead.
You had it before?
No, we did last week, but I want to put it back in the rotation. No. Tell us what it is.
The Incredible Melting Man.
Yes.
It has drama, it has comedy, it has pathos, it has everything.
It has people melting from sun exposure.
That's right.
And also becoming possibly homicidal.
Weren't they? Yeah, they...
Well, very much so.
That became the bit. If you remember from last week, was that the guy got... It was a spaceman. He got too close to the sun. He came back. He started to melt, and he also wanted to kill people.
Yeah.
Oh.
Actually, he was on a space mission around Saturn. And...
Sure.
In a great dramatic reading, he says, "You have never lived until you've seen the sun through the rings of Saturn." And at that moment, they all look like they're in great pain. Next thing you know, the spaceship comes back, and he's melting. They find out he needs copious quantities of blood, or else he will continue.
Well, I heard that when you melt, you
get to see these wonderful scenes. One in particular, an elderly couple are in a car, and they're... they drive off into a field because they're going to do a little canoodling.
As elderly couples often do.
Yes, exactly. The next thing you know, the incredible melting man is in their back seat, and he kills them.
With a hook for a hand.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. No, that's a different movie.
In the next scene, you see him holding one of their heads.
Oh, goodness.
And he throws it over into a stream. You see this in slow motion, mind you.
Wow.
And
this
is great.
It goes down the stream, goes over a little waterfall, and then when it hits the bottom, about 8 gallons of blood.
Oh, so great. All right, Mark.
Yeah.
This is a great one.
Yeah.
You are in the front. I mean, this the reason we took this one again was because last week it got to a runner-up. It was like number three on the list.
It was almost there.
And you sold it.
I vaguely remember this movie.
Yeah.
There's a scene in the forest where they're chasing after him, and they look over, and there is his ear hanging on a bush.
I hate when that happens.
Thanks, Mark.
No.
Walking through the woods and your ear catches on a bush.
Last week we were talking about how the movie ends with him just being a puddle of clothes, and the garbage guy takes him out. It's so anticlimactic.
I know. I like that one's leading. All right, yeah, John, what do you got, John? What justifies your love for the worst movie of all time?
Yeah, this is a great worst bad movie. This is Godzilla, King of the Monsters.
Sure.
1956. And what it is, it's an Americanized remake of the original Japanese from 2 years ago, from 2 years before, 1954, called like Gojira, Japanese directors. And it's got all Japanese actors. So in the U.S., filmmakers, they saw an opportunity here, so they take Raymond Burr. This was the year before.
Oh, goodness.
Because Raymond Burr plus Godzilla equals movie magic.
Box office gold.
Bonanza.
So, goes over to Tokyo as a reporter, and Godzilla, by the way, he's a prehistoric beast that's awakened from atomic testing, right?
Yeah.
So serious horror movie, the Japanese version. So they take the exact same footage. But now, all of a sudden, the Japanese actors, now they all speak English, and it's
dubbed. Oh, my gosh.
Having conversations with Raymond Burr. Like, rewriting, big parts of the plot. And, naturally, they're never in the same scene.
Yeah, so they would probably do a lot of takeaways.
They're intercutting the footage.
Yeah.
Man, John, that's good. That's a good
one. That's really good.
All right, thanks, John.
Yep.
That's a good one.
That's the laziest.
Because I was going to say, where does Godzilla... Because I think of movies like Godzilla, and even a little bit Puma Man falls in this category, as the sort of MST3K. That's going to make it on the screen.
Those Z-grade horror or Z-grade sci-fi movies, they're still great to do. They're really fun. The first movie we ever did that Edward directed was Devil Girl from Mars. Which, super fun. Yeah.
Starring Diana Slickman.
Yep, as the Devil Girl.
And we remounted it when we did like the 10th anniversary with Dina Connelly.
So but definitely those are always ripe for.
Right.
Yeah.
312-981-7200, the phone number. Some good stuff coming in. I know this one. This one is called 847. Says Super Fuzz.
Oh.
A cop gets caught in an atomic blast and gains superpowers. His only weakness is when he sees the color red. He then gets falsely
like
accused
bull.
And convicted for murder, sentenced to death, and has a montage of his failed executions.
What year is this?
There's more.
73.
They're all in the 70s,
I'm going to say,
right?
This is 1973.
You know why I'm confused is because I'm thinking of Hot Fuzz, which was recent.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what I thought, too. Yeah. Super Fuzz.
Super Fuzz.
Super Fuzz.
What does the name mean, even?
Like Super Cop, maybe?
Super Cop?
Yeah. Well, Fuzz. Fuzz.
Yeah, the Fuzz.
Do you not remember when policemen...
I'm just saying I don't understand what the... Did I miss that stars a cop?
Yeah, was it a follow-up on Superfly?
Could be.
Superfly then is exposed to radiation, and he turns into Super Fuzz.
All right, here you go. I feel like we did this one maybe the first week. 847, The Incredible Two-Headed Transplant.
No.
With Jack Nicholson and Pat Priest. Was so bad but popular, and they made a remake with Rosie Grier. Doctor attaches the head of a sex maniac to a mentally challenged farmer.
Ray Milland. Rosie Grier and Ray Milland. Yeah,
we talked about a couple of those those, you know, transplant.
Attach it,
but not that one. Not that one in particular.
That could be a good one.
That's great.
Wait, what's it called? Nicholson and who?
The Incredible Two-Headed Transplant.
I don't know Jack if that's Nicholson?
Jack Nicholson and Pat Priest.
Well, Jack Nicholson, remember, was friends with Roger Corman.
Good point, yes.
And he started off his career doing a lot of these chintzy B-movies. Yeah.
Really?
Yep.
And he's in a lot of like those Edgar Allan Poe adaptations that Roger Corman did with Vincent Price.
That's right. Okay,
and
yes.
Jack Nicholson was, you know, this young, like strapping young actor, so he would be usually the good guy, the male romantic lead.
Except in Little Shop of Horrors, where he plays the dentist, right?
Exactly.
Oh, there you go.
Exactly.
All right. So. All right. 312-981-7200.
You're welcome.
That's what you're here for. You're welcome.
This is why I like having Edward and
Edward
and
Thomas
Herrera,
Rachel Klaff in studio. We're justifying our love for the best worst movies of all time, and we're at the halfway point. The Incredible Melting Man. Just
good
Mark's
explanation. Just the description
of it was
alone.
So good.
Yeah.
That's a leader right now. But I got some good text of movies that I think you guys are going to like. We'll do that after the news here on 720 WGN. Stay with us.
For you to justify my love.
I remember when that song was sexy.
It's hard to listen to, isn't it?
1987, 88.
It was the late 80s.
Yeah.
It's when she got, she went with a, almost like a theme album.
Yeah, right before the erotica stuff.
It was from Bedtime Stories, I think.
No, before that. Justify My Love was before erotica.
It might have been on Express Yourself, like that record, whatever record that was.
Express Yourself, I think, was on, and here I'm portraying how much I know about
Madonna.
No, that was on the, I can't think of it.
the Madonna record.
I think that was from the Like a Prayer video.
That might have been the same album. Justify Your Love was like the sixth single on that
I
one.
I think it was,
All right, anyway. All right. It's a download here on 720 WGN.
I'm such a terrible gay man. I don't know my Madonna albums.
You know, you generalize. You know of Madonna, so that's good.
Yeah,
she's been in some stinkers. Talk about career pivots.
Oh, we should do like a whole
body
festival.
Of evidence. Isn't she in Body of Evidence?
A festival of just Madonna.
Oh my God, they're bad. Shanghai Surprise.
And we get Noelle Krim to play Madonna.
Done. I'm sold.
Done. Rachel Klaff, Edward Thomas Herrera in studio tonight. We're justifying our love for the best worst movies of all time. This idea that we did a series of Thursday nights based on the, it came from the Neo Futurarium series, the Great Summer series that staged readings of the worst movies of all time. They've been doing it for years. How many years is that?
This is, we took a break, but this is our 12th.
12th year.
Time,
The first one was in 2002.
2002.
Wow. Yep. And Someone I Touched is the final movie that will be on stage this Saturday. Edward is the director, 7:30 at the Neo Futurarium at Foster and Ashland in Andersonville. All right, we got a lot to get to. Let's get to these guys. Let's go to Mike. Mike, what justify your love for the best worst movie of all time?
All right, this one's called Sonny Boy, as in our child Sonny.
This is a bad one, super bad.
If you ever wanted to see David Carradine in drag, you're in luck.
He plays a transvestite. Correct.
As Pearl, he's the mother of a monstrous family that terrorizes a small desert town.
Yeah.
Okay.
You decide whether this is funny on purpose or bad. Either way, it's pretty bizarre.
Well, I love it. I love your description of it. All right. Thanks, Mike. We'll put that one down. I like that. Thank you, buddy.
It's pretty bizarre. All right. Bye.
All right. Bye. All right, Harold, what do you got for the best worst movie of all time?
Hey guys, what's going on? Day of the Animals. IMDb gives it the synopsis as a battle for survival as hikers encounter in chemically imbalanced forest. this is the long-awaited first time you see Leslie Nielsen without a shirt.
Yeah,
as he fights a grizzly bear.
He fights a grizzly bear?
He takes the shirt off.
Leslie Nielsen shows up in a lot of these.
Yeah, yeah.
For 10 minutes, he fights the grizzly bear shirtless.
Sure he does.
Both of them, yes.
I'm putting this down on my must-see list.
The IMDb description is equally bonkers. which says animals attack a guide, a newswoman and an ad man, and other hikers because of aerosols in the ozone layer.
We used to be, hey, can back someone... in the, this, wait, I'm going to guess the year of this movie, yeah. 77. But we were really worried about aerosols back
apparently
in the 70s.
Apparently, they make animals go bonkers.
Yeah.
Well, glad we got rid of those aerosols.
And they give, you know, penguins skin cancer.
The poster features a very angry, I think it's a, what is that?
That looks like a mountain lion.
A mountain lion.
Yeah, yeah.
This looks great.
It looks like it's crazed by aerosol.
I would like to try this as a stage reading just to figure out how to do all the animal effects.
I love it. Thanks, Harold.
Puppets.
Puppets.
Take care, guys.
Puppets.
All right.
Or children. Children.
Children.
In animal
Speaking
costumes.
Of children, we got to get back. We didn't get a chance to I forgot the gentleman's name right at the top. He was talking about the movie. I forgot the Cheech and Chong movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he had said, it was with that child molester.
Oh, God.
And it turns out it was Paul Rubens.
Yeah, who is not a child molester.
Not a child molester.
No.
And a bunch of people wrote in to say, no, it's Pee Wee Herman, it's Paul Rubens. Yeah. But the idea, like...
We need to clear his name.
Yeah, we need to clear the name.
Yeah.
Like, that's...
He was arrested for indecent exposure, but
That's not really clearing his name. But okay.
Well, it cleared.
It's way less of a problem.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know. Right. So, come on. I'm just saying. All right. 312-981-7200. I think Paul would be happy with us tonight. We cleared his name.
At least we straightened
out the
facts.
We love you, Pee
Wee. All right. 630 says the movie Squirm. S-Q-U-I-R-M. Squirm. It's about killer worms.
Killer worms.
Yeah.
This sounds like one of those, we talked about this, where they run out of ideas and it's like, I don't know, killer what now? You know, we've done all the different killer things.
And I think Squirm sounds like it's a takeoff on which was all about the snakes, remember?
It was literally
and
called
And Night of the Lepus, which, you know.
Which we've talked about. Killer bunnies.
Animal that is, you
I gotta
know,
say, of all the killer things, worms, really, that's a stretch. Because unless you're throwing them at someone.
Or maybe they're big.
If they're 10 feet long.
Well, then you get tremors.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right.
Right.
But see, tremors, maybe tremors has advanced the story, where tremors was about, they had teeth and stuff like
that,
right?
Yeah. And that was intentionally silly, that movie. Yeah. Although we did end up doing it because we had a twist on it. We did Tremors edited for television, where the narrators stood and substituted words for all the curse words, and they were terrific. They were great.
All right, good.
That was the house theater. They were wonderful.
Oh, I love those guys.
Yeah.
All right, so right now, I'm looking at, you got Incredible Melting Man.
Yep.
Yeah.
You got Godzilla, King of the Monsters.
I'm still thinking about that ear on the bush.
Right. You got Mike just gave us Sonny Boy.
Sonny Boy, yep.
And then Harold gave us Day of the Animals.
I love that. It's for Melting Man and Day of the Animals for me.
I'm still stuck on that ear. So
he painted a very vivid picture.
Yeah. I have to say, just for his synopsis skills alone, I think that gets my vote.
All right. So Amy Guth, who's coming up here at 11 o'clock, she just wrote in. She gave us two choices.
Okay.
She said the movie Hamburger.
Yes.
Which is a camp-like movie. Right?
Teen,
it's like a Meatballs ripoff.
Sort of teen, subpar teen sex romp. Maybe not so much
meatballs
on the sex.
Meatballs and then hamburger.
Yeah,
and
I think that's the idea.
The next one is what?
Porky's.
Lasagna.
Yeah. Yeah. Porky's. Yeah. A lot of meat theme.
A lot of, it's a meat.
Yeah,
meat
it's a kid who like needs to
camp.
Get his diploma and he ends up at a hamburger universe. I don't know. It's so silly. Silly.
Does it star C. Thomas Howell?
It does not, strangely enough.
But don't you think it should?
It should. It should.
Usually,
this is the most fun part is like just hearing these titles and then just immediately see Thomas Howell is in that.
Pretty sure.
Leslie Nielsen shows up in a lot because Leslie Nielsen was in Viva Knievel, as Pete just mentioned. He had some role in it.
And don't forget, Leslie Nielsen was in that movie about the grasshoppers attacking Chicago.
The Beginning of the End? I think that's what it's called.
Which
somebody nominated.
That's a brilliant film.
It's so good.
Especially when you look at that beautiful scene where they're crawling up the Wrigley Building. And then they start to crawl. And as they continue to crawl, they start to like veer
crawl
off
into the sky
into
because
the
they're on acetate. Yeah.
Because they're just sitting on a... They're really crawling
it's
across
so
a
great.
Photograph of the Wrigley Building.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Amy said the second choice would be Midnight Madness.
I don't know that one.
I don't know what Midnight Madness is.
Okay, but let me guess who's in it. I'm thinking 1973.
Midnight Madness.
Karen Valentine.
You're good. This is good. Let's see. Midnight Madness, 19. What did you say?
73.
You're always saying 73. This is 1980.
Okay, close enough.
It's
close
a comedy. Enough.
It all those years roll together.
Midnight Madness is Karen Valentine in it?
No. David. I can't see the cast. But Michael J. Fox.
Oh, he showed up in last week.
He
was
did
a,
with
yeah.
the Joan Jett movie.
The Joan Jett brother sister rock and roll music.
Yep.
Oh my God. Yeah. David Naughton. About that
can't
movie.
Read that. Yeah. This is a silly comedy.
Amy
Midnight
likes
Madness.
She likes the silly comedies.
Okay.
Sure. All right. Yeah. Fair enough.
All right, let's keep going here. All right, 312-981-7200. Fallen Angel.
We couldn't
1981.
Okay.
So disturbing, it still makes my skin crawl. I'm partial to the music video of Fallen Angel by the band Poison.
Who wouldn't be?
Which is literally, they do the song where a woman gets off the bus to go to Hollywood. And it's a cautionary tale song slash video from the band Poison about,
because when Poison knows a thing or two about young women in Hollywood.
Oh, gosh. Sure. Oh, this looks awful. It's a made-for-TV movie, and just the description alone makes you squirm. A girl and others her age are lured by their softball coach, an insidious child pornographer.
Oh, no.
No. Terrible. This is another drama movie of the week.
Wait. Linda Blair.
Nope. Melinda Dillon.
Oh.
One of the best names in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Melinda Dillon.
That rolls right off
Shame
the tongue.
Shame on her.
I know, but I love Melinda
Ronnie
Dillon.
Ronnie Cox.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Ronnie
the
Cox.
Christmas Story. I will always remember Melinda Dillon.
Dana Hill.
Isn't she in that?
And Richard Mazur.
I think so. I don't know. Richard Mazur, okay.
Shame on all of them. That sounds awful.
It's like the Gacy made-for-TV that Brian Dennehy played.
Yes.
Got that one scene where he's dressed as a clown pumping gas.
Oh, no. It's terrible.
He's talking to the kid, and he like has the face contorts, and you're just like, that is the worst, evilest scene of all time.
Yeah, that would this movie
he's
would
pumping
make me squirm
gas,
too.
He's at the gas station,
okay,
and he's like, well, the boy gas. Who's like, full service in the gas station. He's got his attention because Gacy and
Boyce. Yeah,
oh, no.
And he's dressed in full clown. He's like, what's your name? And he's just got this look, and you're like, that is the worst, like. I mean, it's creepy beyond creepy, but you're like, what a, like, Dennehy, like, just method acting,
but
getting into it.
Does that count as bad?
It's bad. Well,
it's creepy?
I don't know if that falls into the category of bad, although I'm sure many would say it did.
It depends. All of those sort of exploitation films, made-for-TV exploitation films of horrible, horrible crimes or, serial killers, I always just find, like, I don't know about this. Like, it makes me uncomfortable.
Although I have to say, Hey, I'm Alive with Ed Asner and Sally Struthers as the two people who are like crashed. Their plane crashes in the wilderness of Alaska, and they're trying to get rescued.
Hey, I'm Alive.
I've always wanted to do
that. Yeah, that's
that
a wonderful
movie.
How did we not? It just occurred to me because I started thinking about 847 says Melinda Dillon was in Slapshot.
She was. Know?
And 773 gives us Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Again.
And I was thinking, I don't know how this one, and I want to bring it back, just because I feel like it didn't make it. For some reason, we gave it an asterisk. It didn't win.
Yep.
But Boy in the Bubble.
Boy in the Plastic Bubble.
Oh,
with John Travolta.
John Travolta.
How did that not make our list?
We
that
were close.
It was close, right?
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that bad movie. I mean, it's such a bad movie.
Yep. That's a really good one. I don't know that we.
Gina,
I don't know that anybody.
Come back and talk to me. They're on the beach. And they brought the bubble down to the beach, and he's like playing and having fun.
Well, if we do it now, we know who we're going to hit up to play the lead. Gina. Justin
the
Kaufman.
The outfit for the boy in the bubble, like when he's on the beach.
Yeah.
I think it's basically just something that they got out of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Yeah.
And they just basically
repurposed
said, like,
it.
Hey, you know what? I've got this great outfit. It looks like a scuba diving outfit. I think it will
work
for the boy.
Just repurpose
like
it.
When he's running along the beach.
Yeah.
He's having fun with Gina.
Yeah.
And Gina starts to run away to her other friends.
Hey, yeah. Gina.
And it's Gina. Where are you going? Come back and talk to me. And then she's like, Danny, it's Greece. But I'm like,
I love that
John, you're in a bubble. No. And he has a moment of recognition that he's in a bubble, and he tries to break out of the bubble. And Bob's like, oh, what are you doing? Don't you break out of that bubble. You're going to die. such a good
I really thing. Love I that Justin this is your takeaway from this film.
Oh, I think he's auditioning for
the role. Serious testosterone right there. Like, I just, I want to be Travolta.
The casting couch is here.
All right, let me.
Whoa. Okay. We've got all these windows out into Michigan Avenue. I don't know.
Speaking of reconsideration, Peter wants us to reconsider a movie. Peter, what's the movie?
The movie is one of the most atrocious things I've ever seen, and it was done entirely as an on-purpose good movie. They weren't. I really don't think they were trying to be bad. And that's The Warrior and The Sorceress.
And The Sorceress, yes. Mm-hmm. Also David Carradine, right?
And it also made it to like the second. We almost picked it, but I think Rabbit Test or one of the ones got in right before.
Yep.
Maria Sokas made, I think, her North American movie premiere as an actress.
Wasn't this the one shot in South America?
Well, in Mexico.
Oh, in Mexico, okay.
And basically, Carradine plays a warrior who does essentially for a few dollars more plot line. There's two warring parties in a village fighting over the one well, and he decides to play them against each other for money.
Oh, I think actually that's a Kurosawa. I think that's Sanjuro. That's a Kurosawa.
Well, you're going back farther than I am.
I'm going back to the original. You're welcome.
I didn't know the name. I didn't know the name.
This
so
is
thank
the,
you.
The cheap, you're the cheap ripoff.
All right, Peter, that's a good one. I like it.
That's a good
thank
one.
You thank so you so much for bringing so much. That one back.
I think he made a great point, though. It's like the great things that makes a movie so bad is when the intention behind it is absolutely
and if I remember, Carradine's at the top. We did this. It was
we talked about
the poster,
which is, as I think Peter described really vividly, is Arnold Schwarzenegger's body with Carradine's head. And it really is. It's, so you know, as this muscle
312
man.
Says, actually, the beginning of the end.
Right.
Has yes. Peter Graves, not Leslie Nielsen.
Oh.
But I can see the similarity. Both had gray hair in black and white movies. That's what Harold says.
Harold's yeah, right. Well, yeah.
can't
okay.
can't
hey,
win them all.
I get them confused. I still get Lohengrin and Tannhäuser mixed up all the time. One has like a swan at the end.
All right. 612 says, Can't Stop the Music. The collaboration from Steve Guttenberg, The Village People, and Bruce Jenner in Hot Pants.
This is on my list. We did The Apple. Twice we remounted it, and Barrel of Monkeys did an amazing version of it, and
hey,
I've always wanted
hey.
To Bims on the
Bims
Way.
Bims on the Way.
I've always wanted to have them come back and do Bims Can't Stop the Music because that movie
is what just is like so.
It's the Village People.
It's a Village People. It's a vehicle for the Village People who don't act.
No, they do not.
And it stars Bruce Jenner who does not act.
No,
but I have to say. Looks good in a pair of hot pants.
He sure does. He looks good
Is this right around like Olympics time?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's 1980. It might be earlier than that.
But what it is, it's like they've decided they're discovering this great new band, and it's called The Village People.
Yeah.
And here's a construction worker, and here's a guy dressed like a Native American.
Yeah. Oh, so it's actually about the Village People.
Yeah, it's kind of like an origin story.
I thought they were, that's hilarious.
Like the X-Men, only they sing, and they're all dressed like gay stereotypes.
Terrifically bad,
but it's hilarious. And Valerie Perrine is in it, isn't she? Mm-hmm. She's the one who's like going, "These guys, you got to hear them; they're great."
Oh my gosh!
Oh wow! Yeah. All right, 630 says, "How about Motel Hell? Chainsaw fight while wearing a severed pig head."
Oh, God. Okay, yikes. That's recent, not to love. It's not. It's we were talking about doing this. Yeah, it's the guy who runs a motel where they kill and they plant the bodies in the. In the garden out back or crazy thing. Yeah, it's really insane.
Wow. Okay. All right. I know I've got some more here. I just got to get down to them. Condor Man.
We were just saying, does he battle Puma Man?
Yeah, right.
Because I would watch that.
Oh, and then we could do Puma Man versus Condor Man.
Exactly. Right. Puma Man.
224 says the pirate movie starring Christy McNichol and Christopher Adkins.
Yep.
And anything with Christy McNichol, just that.
Plus, it's called the pirate movie. How lazy do you have to be?
Yeah.
224 says it's the only movie they ever walked out on.
Yeah, it's not good. It is not good.
It's just not good.
I walked out of Jesus Christ Superstar.
It's trying to be a funny.
But that's because my mother thought
comedy.
We were going to see King of Kings, and she was really disappointed.
It's sort of a fantasy comedy trying to be lighthearted musical romp, and it ends up being none of those things.
All right, here's the 773 has the 1965 film Die, Die, My Darling.
Yes.
A young girl is kept prisoner in an attic and is terrorized by her dead fiancé's crazy whack job mother. It stars Stephanie Powers, Tallulah Bankhead, and Donald Sutherland as a weirdo gardener. This movie's so bad it's good. I think it may have gotten a Rotten Tomato Award.
Yeah, I think this was part of that whole series in the late 60s, 70s when they would get these really famous faded movie stars mm-hmm. like Bette Davis or Joan Crawford or Tallulah Bankhead.
Right.
And they would say, I think they called it hagsploitation.
Oh.
And I'm not, that's not something I made up.
That's incredibly.
They would call it hagsploitation, where they would take older female actresses, big names, and then make them monsters into these
sort things. Of like Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Yeah.
The Nanny with mm-hmm. with Bette Davis, yeah. where she plays the psycho nanny.
Yep.
Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte, you know.
Sure.
There's tons of them.
But this was
I think most of them starred Joan Crawford, because that woman, she'll work for anything.
She's a worker.
She would work. Straight Jacket. That's what I'm thinking.
Straight Jacket. Yeah. Yes.
All right. This is a little early. That's a little precursor.
It's certainly a great title.
All right. Three more, and then we'll stop, and we'll semi stop. These and get them to Pete and see what he thinks. All right.
Okay.
224's Basket Case.
Basket Case. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's about the young man who has his conjoined twin in a basket.
Yep.
Except the basket contains only his head and like hands. And of course, the basket twin is a killer.
Yeah.
And like the one guy, he's like this really nice looking guy. I know this movie.
Yep. Yep. You do.
And he's like this normal little quiet guy, but he's got this secret basket. What's in the basket? Oh, it's my twin brother.
Not only my Siamese twin, my telepathic Siamese twin.
Oh, that's
brother.
Right. But he's also violent and homicidal. And people, like, you know, eventually he finds someone who wants to look in the basket, and that's the last thing they
That
see.
Would be a fun one to do as a puppet show.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, I've got 708 says HOTS, HOTS, starring Danny Bonaducci and a seal.
Yeah, yeah.
I love it already.
That's an acronym.
HOTS,
right?
Yeah.
Oh boy.
HOTS.
I don't know. I don't know anything about it.
Stands for seal.
1979.
I was going to say 73.
Right? Oh, it's like a sorority sister. Sorority sisters of Old Pie rival those of HOTS, HOTS, for dibs on campus hunks.
Played by Danny Bonaducci.
That's right. Scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Oh, man.
2009 movie Dogtooth.
Oh.
Wait.
That's
the Greek film?
I don't know. Dogtooth.
There's a Greek film called Dogtooth.
2009.
About, yeah. Well, it
was. Is Dogtooth the what's his name? Nope. You're right. It's Greek.
It's a Greek film. And it's about a man who raises his children in total seclusion.
Yes.
But that's not a bad film. That's a good one.
It's a good film.
It's hilariously funny, too.
It's an art film.
Unless it's a different Dogtooth that we're talking about.
What am I thinking of? I'm thinking of Lars von Trier, Dogville. Is it Dogville?
Yeah.
Anyway, doesn't matter. That's movies.
And the last one, 773, gives us Billy Jack.
We did Billy Jack, it is dreadful. Yeah. And there's a bunch of Billy Jack films, I think. This, yeah, it's really terrible.
I wasn't in it. I wanted to play the Buffy St. Marie role.
Yeah,
but I didn't do well at my audition.
It's really entertaining.
I can do the voice.
I can do the
Buffy St. Marie voice.
Billy Jack is a really good example of one that was being real serious about Native American rights and ends up being...
Yeah.
Just awful.
All right. Well, we're giving away a pair of tickets to the 10th annual Chicago Blackhawks convention at the Hilton Chicago Hotel on July 21st through the 23rd. Stop by and join our live broadcast on the 21st with Rokan, 22nd with The Beat, all brought to you by Meijer, now offering home delivery across Chicagoland. All right. So here's the semifinalists, and we'll get through these and we'll wrap them up. We've got The Incredible Melting Man.
Yep.
We've got the movie Sunny Boy.
Mm-hmm.
We've got The Warrior and the Sorceress. We've got Can't Stop the Music. Die, Die, My Darling. in the movie Basket Case.
Did we forgot Day of the Animals, didn't we?
I did.
By the way, my man spouse says that Basket Case is a satire.
All right.
Oh, okay. Which, so it's out. Know, all right. So we can't. Like, okay. Yeah, so Pete, let's count. Jump in. We're taking Basket Case out.
Sorry. No. Spouse. You know,
Incredible Melting Man.
Yep.
Sunny Boy. What do you guys like? What do you like? Incredible Melting Man, no. Sunny Boy, Day of the
There's
Animals.
There's the ear yeah. on the bush.
Incredible Melting Man is great. I want to give a nod to Warrior and the Sorceress just because it was so doggedly pitched to us.
All right, Pete, what do you think?
I agree with those two. Which one has space?
Incredible Melting Man.
Let's
has
go
space.
The one with
there
space.
You yeah. go.
Space always wins.
And here's what we'll do, just to make it an eight. Movies, right? Mm-hmm. Eight movies for our final, whatever we do with these eight.
Right.
We're going to also enter in The Warrior and the Sorceress.
Great.
And I'll give him a pizza for that. And then just for my own, because I think it's the best movie of all time, Boy in a Plastic Bottle gets in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I get the chef's choice on that one. Rachel Claff, Edward Thomas Herrera. You guys, it was so fun. This was Rachel's
super
great.
Fun.
Thank you so
much. We
need
to do this forever.
Yeah, you can
forever.
Just kind of do it in perpetuity.
We have eight great movies that came out of this series.
I'll be
go
back
see,
next week.
There you go. Go see It Came from the Neo-Futurarium. Someone I touched. Saturday night, 7:30 at Foster and Ashland at the Neo-Futurarium.
There's a singing bacterium in it.
Alright, that's going to do it for the download tonight. Jen Bosworth and Amy Guth in studio for Patty Vasquez. Good to see you guys.
Nice to see you.
Hello.
Alright, so what's on the show tonight?
Well.
Oh, you're right. Oh, yeah.
We've
okay.
got a whole...
okay.
Oh, wait, are we doing a show?
Yes, we are, I think. We've got Wild Claw Theater folks.
Mm-hmm.
So Mandy
They're
Walsh
fun.
And Josh.
Josh Segoran,
who loves you, by the way.
Josh would have been... Josh had done this bit, the bad movies before.
That was so fun. Yeah. That was very fun
Isn't
to listen
fun?
To that.
Very,
that was
I was
very
in
fun.
One of those.
Just you were?
I was in the one... It was a women's prison one. I was in one. I played... Trixie or something like that. Anyway, they're hilarious.
It is a thing, man. I did one back in, they said that it began in 2002, and Schadenfurt did the first season. We did 2002. We did the movie Up the Creek, which is a classic camp kind of ripoff of Animal House, but on rafts.
Never heard
of-
Oh,
so
that's
it's like
pretty
a river
cool.
raft kind of thing where they got all the different sororities and fraternities have to race, and there's like the military and the jocks.
Yeah.
And,
what year was this movie?
Early 80s, like an 82 kind of thing.
Wow.
Yeah. Starred Tim Matheson.
Let me go sidebar for a minute and say that Rex Hupke of Guth and Hupke on Politics just tweeted, "This is the night I called WGN Radio to get mad at Amy Guth for radio cheating on me with Jen Bosworth."
Well, there you
I
go.
I wanted him to call so we could have a therapy session.
# Guth Hupke fight.
Yeah. I want him to call and we could have a therapy.
Bring
like,
it, Hupke.
And be like, listen,
talk about what
I
you're feeling.
I hear what you're saying.
But when you say, I feel.
Yeah. I statements.
I statements.
I statements.
I am going to hang up now. Click. Well, that's how I
that's
do
it. Great about, that's great about Wild Claw. I wanted to have those guys in. They do horror films.
Oh, they're
or
so
horror
fun.
Stage. Yeah.
And they have like the Foley table right there doing sound effects.
And
it's cool. It's
I'm
fun.
In a play right now with both of them at the factory. Yep. Fight City.
Look at you.
Mover and a
That's going to be a good show. That's like.
Fight City, a prison babe. I mean, this is, this is
no,
going to be a good show.
No, Mark here, you don't even know. It's women's, it's like a all women combat show.
And there's blood and gore.
It's chicks
blood
kicking
packs.
Ass.
Teeth go flying, Rob, right up your alley.
Ooh. Nice. I'm
right
in.
Up your alley. I don't know. Right up my alley.
There you go.
There we go.
All right, well, have a great show.
Thank you.